Arcade. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Past the hour, this is the Thursday edition of The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. You know that. My apologies about yesterday, but frankly, it weren't my fault. Anytime we see phone company trucks running up and down our little road here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West Bicod, Virginia, it spells... Well, it doesn't spell anything good for us and our connection here. And such was the case yesterday. It's been a weird couple of days. Yesterday it was phone company trucks running up and down the road. And then today, I'd say about an hour and a half ago, maybe 2 hours ago, the whole house was turned on its ear when a flight of fighter jets, five of them, went over the house at maybe somewhere between 500 and 1,000 feet, and just about rattled the windows out of the building. Thanks, guys. We'll sleep better tonight knowing you're on the job. I guess they're doing aerial surveillance for hillbilly car bombers or something. Though how you can see anything at that speed, I'll never know. Yeah, it was a little weird. Broke the sound barrier, everything. I got a feeling that's not according to Hoyle, but like I'm going to complain. I mean, these guys are notorious for, you know, bombing wedding parties and saying oopsie and machine-gunning journalists and saying, I'll be damned, I thought the camera was a gun. You all saw it, he had a camera. So, nah, I probably won't complain. Beyond that, I hated missing the program last night because it was the prayer meeting Wednesday. But in a way, I suppose we can make up for it. Because this is, after all, the National Day of Prayer. Hallelujah. Glory to God. Franklin Graham, who wasn't allowed to pray at the Pentagon. Oh, my God. These poor little attention whores. Because he was disinvited, because he is a hate-filled maggot, Franklin Graham decided to pray in the parking lot of the Pentagon. Dear Father, bless this asphalt to thy mercy and thy glory. No, really, I'm not kidding. Whining and pissing and moaning about having been banned by the Pentagon from sharing God's love. I love you. Franklin Graham went out there. Yeah. And prayed in the in the parking lot. Really? And see, that stuff really, really rubs up against me. For a variety of reasons. How can I explain this? I've described myself on a number of occasions as a recovering Southern Baptist. Because what they do to your mind when you are a child and a young person in that fundamentalist church, if another government was doing it to an American citizen, we would declare it a violation of the Geneva Conventions. It's awful. And it's not limited to Southern Baptists. Lord knows how many times Bart Kopp has remarked on his page about the things that were done to his mind as he was raised Roman Catholic. I imagine there are recovering Lutherans out there, if you want to get right down to it. Maybe even recovering Hindus. But for me, it's a matter of being a recovering Southern Baptist. And, of course, Billy Graham, who is the father of Franklin Graham, comes out of that Baptist tradition, that tent meeting tradition. And when you're little and you're in the basement of the Baptist church and the little old blue-haired ladies are teaching you all about, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that whosoever might believeth upon him might have everlasting life, and do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and you're all sitting in a circle singing, Jesus loves the little children. And then they let, when you're old enough to make, when they're old enough that they're fairly sure that you're not going to either vomit, fart, belch, or, you know, do anything else in the service, they'll let you go up to big church. And that's where you go from, you know, dear Jesus, take care of my best friend. Amen. To those great big long-winded prayers that the deacons give because they're showing off their praying skills at the same time they're showing off their new Botany 500 polyester three-piece suit in a sort of muted forest green with gold stitching along the lapels and their little plastic carnation boutonniere, if you will. And it creates a little bit of cognitive dissonance because all along you've been encouraged to read the Bible. And, you know, the first book of the New Testament's Matthew. And you don't have to go far into Matthew before you get to Matthew chapter 6. And I think I've remarked upon this before, but it bears repeating. If you want to understand what a sick, pernicious, perfidious, ain't a word of truth in him piece of human rubbish Franklin Graham is, then all you got to do is read Matthew chapter 6 of the book that he claims guides his life. Not yours, not mine. His. Take heed that you do not do your alms before men to be seen of them. Otherwise, you have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. What does Franklin Graham run? Franklin Graham runs Samaritan's Purse. Samaritan's Purse owns Gulfstream Jets. Do you remember back when Caribou Barbie was crisscrossing the country on her bus tour? Well, while all the peons were on the bus, Mussolini was jetting around the country on a private jet owned by Samaritan's Purse. Imagine that. Nickels, dimes, quarters, dollar bills, fins, tens, century notes. Sent in by people from all over the country because Samaritan's Purse was going to go out and take care of the poor and the needy all over the world. Amen, amen, amen. And they bought a Gulfstream jet! And then they used it to fly Sarah Palin to her bus tours. Because, well, that you remember in the intro to Green Acres, that line, Lisa Douglas standing there with her little pooch in their Manhattan penthouse apartment. But darling, I get allergic smelling hay. Well, Mussolini gets allergic smelling diesel bus fuel. And she don't want to be down there rolling the roads. She wants to fly, baby, fly. And so she did. In a jet donated to her for her use by Franklin Graham's Samaritan's Purse. And thus we find ourselves back at Matthew chapter 6, verse 1. Take heed that ye do not your alms before men to be seen of them. Otherwise ye have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. Therefore, when thou doest thine alms, do not sound a trumpet before thee, or for that matter a jet engine, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory of men. Verily, I say unto you, they have their reward. Really, Jesus. Because see, this isn't somebody, I mean, if you had your red letter New Testament out, you would find that these are all red letters. These are sayings of Jesus, the guy that Franklin Graham worships as the God that his daddy God sent to earth by raping a teenage Jewish girl. I couldn't make that stuff up if I tried. And he says that. And Franklin Graham does that. Kind of reaches back into his sinuses and dredges up a real good sinus oyster and right on Jesus. But when thou dost alms, let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth. Yeah. You know what? That may be all in the world we need to understand George Reeker and his little rentboy.com problem. But we'll get to that later. Let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth. That thine alms may be in secret. And thy Father, which seeth in secret himself, shall reward thee openly. Oh, and this is a big one when it comes to praying in the parking lot of the Pentagon, whether it's an impeccatory prayer or something else. And when thou prayest, thou shalt not be as the hypocrites are. For they love to pray standing in the synagogues and in the corners of the streets and the Pentagon parking lots, that they may be seen of men. Verily, I say unto you, they have their reward. But thou, when thou prayest, enter into thy closet. And when it comes to the American fundamentalist evangelicals, that's the one place where we can say that they are doctrinally pure, because many of them are already in the closet, like Reverend Reeker. But thou, when thou prayest, enter into thy closet, and when thou hast shut thy door, call thy rent boy. No. And when thou hast shut thy door, pray to thy Father which is in secret. And thy Father, which seeth in secret, shall reward thee openly. This is troublesome. How do you square up Franklin Graham with the absolutely unambiguous words of Yeshua, the Palestinian day laborer? How do you do that? Graham, let's see, where's this come from? Yeah, this is from AOL News. Graham, his wife, and three others prayed for about 5 minutes outside the Pentagon. You know what? It takes a long time. It takes a lot of serious Phariseeing to crank out 5 minutes of praying, even if you're Billy Graham's boy. Graham, his wife, and three others prayed for about 5 minutes outside the Pentagon before visiting the nearby 9/11 memorial and answering reporters' questions. He thanked President Barack Obama for issuing a National Day of Prayer proclamation. Yeah, gee, thanks, Barack. And for instructing the Justice Department to challenge a federal court ruling that declared the event unconstitutional. Way to pander, Barack! But then again, wouldn't you? Come on, you're President of the United States, you've got stuff you want to do, the country is literally falling apart before your very eyes, not by anything of your own doing. You've got more than enough plates in the air right now, and the last thing you need is an issue that will energize the mouth-breathing, drooling, knuckle-walking faithful. See, I told you he's a secret Muslim. He ain't even appealing. He ain't gonna let us pray no more, Jesus! That we don't need. So I understand. I do understand. And I kind of give a pass to Barack Obama for, yeah, appealing this. Here's hoping the lawyers mail in the appeal. Your Honor, we appeal. Is that all you got to say? Pretty much! But Graham did not back down from the views about Islam, that is an evil religion, that got him booted in the first place. Muslims don't agree with the Christian faith, so we have honest disagreements, he said. Adding that he is not out crusading against Islam and has only spoken out when questioned by reporters. Noting that the Pentagon has held Ramadan services, he said, I don't complain about those. And they ought to have Christian services. Now see, that's called the straw man, boys and girls. Because that is not to say that they don't have Christian services. The Pentagon is chock-a-block with chaplains. Jewish chaplains, Christian chaplains, Muslim chaplains, maybe even a Wiccan chaplain or two, who knows? Probably got a Hindu chaplain in there somewhere. Or a Buddhist, maybe. Can't imagine a Buddhist working for the Pentagon, but who knows? But no one has said that they're not having Christian services. What they're saying is that active proselytizing and slurring of one slurs passed by a member of one religion against members of another religion will not be tolerated within the armed services. Because that creates, come on, veterans, work with me here, you know, dissension in the ranks. Damn dirty Muslim, I ain't going to be in no foxhole with you. Well, I would not want to be in a foxhole with you, you idolater. Let's get the atheist. So, Graham went on to explain to reporters because, well, reporters needed explained to them because Lord knows this is a momentous story, that he has a son in Afghanistan. Do you think the reporters didn't know? Every time Franklin Graham stands up, he said, did you know I have a son in Afghanistan? He waves, he literally waves the corporeal existence of his son like the proverbial bloody shirt of old. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised when Franklin Graham's son comes home if he's not wearing a halter top and platform shoes with sequins glued to his face the way that Franklin Graham has whored him out. How many of us have seen that the little Volvo going down the road and it's got a bumper sticker on the back that says, ask me about my honor roll student? Franklin Graham's Cadillac and his Gulfstream jet, for that matter, have bumper stickers that say, ask me about my son serving in Afghanistan. So then he went on over after visiting the 9/11 memorial and after praying for 5 minutes in the parking lot of the Pentagon, went on over to the Capitol. But thou, when thou prayest, enter into thy closet. Do they have porta-johns in the Pentagon parking lot? I don't know. That's the closest you could get to a closet, isn't it? I don't see anything about Franklin Graham going into the porta-john to pray. And when thou hast shut thy door, pray to thy Father which is in secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret shall reward thee openly. But when you pray, use not vain repetitions. O Lord God, Lord of hosts, salvation of our souls, creator of the universe, inventor of frisbees and wheat checks, do thou bless this thy servant, hallelujah, amen, glory, pass me a snake. No, Jesus says don't do that. When you pray, use not vain repetitions as the heathen do, for they think that they shall be heard for their much speaking. Be not ye therefore like unto them, for your Father knoweth what things ye have need of before ye ask him. In other words, Franklin, God knows your boy's in Afghanistan, and God's going to look after him, and if God decides to let a Taliban member put a bright little rosy blossom right between his eyes and end his existence here on earth, it's part of God's plan, Franklin. God already knows you don't have to pray for your dear boy. God's got it covered. If he comes home, it's God's will. If he comes home feet first in a body bag, that's God's will too, Franklin. Get used to it. Quit trying to flog God and get God to do your earthly bidding. That's kind of what that means. And then Jesus says, here, morons, I'm going to tell you how to pray. Do this. And everybody who's ever grown up in any sort of church knows this. It is referred to variously as the Lord's Prayer or the Paternoster. Somebody time me. I'm going to wait here a minute. Somebody time me. Chat room, time me. From the minute that I start this till the minute I get done, time me. This matters. Somebody acknowledge me as soon as the latency of the internet catches up to the chat room, please. Time me. I want to see, because here's what I want to find out. Can you pray the way Jesus said to pray and pull it in under 5 minutes? Okay, anybody there? Is this getting through yet? This is the one downside. This is as live as it can be, but the internet latency thing. Okay, all right. Lottie's got me. Okay. Jesus says, after this manner, therefore, pray ye. Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. Anybody? Time check, please. I'm thinking that wasn't 5 minutes. I'm thinking that was barely 30 seconds. You know, that's one of those, you wouldn't even have your closet door closed before you had the prayer out. You could just sort of wander off into an alley and wipe out the zombies that were back there real quick behind the dumpster and get it said and get back out. 20 seconds, says Lottie in the chat room. So, Franklin Graham, what were the other 4 minutes and 40 seconds for? Somebody, anybody, tell me. Why, wait, I think we know. They were for Yeah, because Franklin Graham, Matthew 6:5, loves to pray standing in the church and in the corners of the streets and on the Pentagon parking lots that he may be seen of men. Verily, I say unto you, he has his reward. When Jesus says he has his reward, isn't he kind of indicating that it ain't going to get much better in the hereafter? That maybe Franklin won't be getting his slice of pie in the sky when he dies? That he may be the main course at the big barbecue joint in hell, sitting there turning forever on a spit, along with Adolf Hitler and Jesse Helms and George Wallace and Strom Thurmond and Jerry Falwell, Lester Maddox. Baste him again, boys. He's looking a bit right tough yet. And they sit there, the little demons, and they pick your bones clean and they lick your ribs. And then magically, you just rematerialize back on the spit, turning over those flames again and again and again and again until the demons baste you again. Maybe sopping up your juices with a little bit of sauce and Wonder Bread. And they do it again. And they do it again. And they do it again. And they do it again for all eternity until the end of time itself. And perhaps, depending on whether you are a pre-millennialist, millennialist, a millennialist, or a post-millennialist, maybe even after the end of time itself. And you know, Jesus goes on and even bothers to explain this for us. He says, if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you forgive men not their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive yours. Moreover, when you fast, be not as the hypocrites of a sad countenance. I'm so hungry. For they disfigure their faces, that they may appear unto men to fast. Well, I guess that one's gone out the window a long while ago, last I checked looking at John Hagee. Matthew 6:19. I think we've got a little something extra here. We've got bonus condemnation for Franklin Graham. Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. You can just see him one Saturday morning going out to go fly to some revival in his Samaritan's Purse Gulfstream jet. Holy God, somebody, a thief done corrupted and stole of Gulfstream. Jesus, why'd you let this happen? Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Anybody. It's Romper Room Radio, you know. I can see everybody out there in the radio land. Anybody want to guess? Anybody, does anybody know, hallelujah, praise Jeebus, does anybody know where Franklin Graham stores up his treasures? Yeah, baby, it's in a hangar in North Carolina. And in a variety of different and sundry banks, because you wouldn't want to be wiped out by one bank going bad, so you spread the donations around a bit so that all your millions are laying about. And you know what? Just because it's in a 501c3 or in some sort of a foundation doesn't mean it's not your wealth. Because at the end of the day, you can still get at it, and you are still in trouble with Jesus Christ! Yes, indeed. The light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be full of light. What are you talking about there, Jesus? Now, sometimes he just said stuff. But if thine eye be evil, thy whole body shall be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in thee be darkness, how great is that darkness? But no man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Sorry, no can do. Pick one, Franklin. The Gulfstream jet, your Samaritan's purse, millions. Or the humble Palestinian day laborer. Glory to God, I choose both. Sorry. When you go and you stand and you make a public show of your praying in the Pentagon parking lot, we know, Franklin Graham, we know. We know who you've chosen, Franklin Graham. We know. You have borne evil fruit. And by your fruit we know ye. Kind of makes a little sense, doesn't it? Marty writes in and says that he's also particularly fond of the next chapter of Matthew, chapter 7. Verse 15. Oh, what might that be? Oh, there it is. Beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. You shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. And a good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that bringeth not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. See? See? Everybody loves barbecue that's smoked over fruit wood. And there we go. And you know, what would you expect in hell except fruit wood that was bearing evil fruit? I mean, it's hell. And Franklin Graham, he gonna slow smoke. Hoo-wee! Maybe one time they'll do him on the spit, and the next time they'll do him Polynesian style and dig a pit for him and bury him and barbecue him that way and cover him up, lay him on the hot, hot coals on a bed of banana leaves and cover him in more wet banana leaves. Just suffocating, and then throw the sand and the dirt in over him and just leave him for a few million years and then bring him out and let the little demons pick the meat off of him while he watches. And then there's that Asian method where they coat you in clay and bake you that way like they do that Vietnamese duck I done seen Tony Bourdain eat one time. Yeah, Franklin Graham, them little demons are going to just encase you in wet clay, wet mud, and they're going to sit you there, and they're going to bake you that way, and you'll sizzle and pop on the inside and be so tender when the little demons come to eat a few millennia, a few eons later. Delicious with sweet taters. How can this be so hard to grasp for evangelicals? And even later, Franklin sat down to an interview with batshit crazy Pat Robertson's Christian Broadcasting Network, and he said that being uninvited from the Pentagon is, quote, mind you, a put-down, because it seems to be that Islam gets a pass, that a couple of Muslims can complain about a Christian event at the Pentagon when there's been a Christian event there for years at the Pentagon. What a dirty, rotten, filthy little liar. Franklin Graham is. Who started this ball rolling? Yes, yes, the Council on American Islamic Relations, CAIR, did chime in later, but this ball got rolling thanks to the dedicated, committed work of who? Yeah, Mikey Weinstein. Let's see, last I checked, Weinstein. No, it doesn't sound like a follower of the prophet, peace be upon him, and upon you, and upon everyone, because no one on this earth of goodwill should be without access to peace. No, Mikey Weinstein's quite Jewish. Secular, but Jewish. But that's okay, Franklin Graham told the drooling, mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, elbow-pad-wearing, helmet-festooned faithful of the Christian Broadcasting Network that the Muslims complained. Mother McCree. I know we have people here of other faiths, and I certainly want to say that I love you. But please allow me to speak today as a minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I don't want to be offensive to anyone, but the only way I know how to pray and to preach is the way the Bible instructs. You lying servant of Satan, Franklin Graham, you. We just read the Bible, Franklin, and it said what it says is the absolute, unqualified antithesis of every damn thing you do in your miserable, filthy, stinking life. It's that simple. That's what he said. That's what he said at the National Day of Prayer event on Capitol Hill. That's what he said. Please allow me to pray. Allow me to pray because, you know, he's a fundamentalist Christian and they got this little old, persecution complex. Because way back, nearly 2,000 years ago, when Christianity was first being founded, well, there was a little philosophical, you know, dust up between the people who wanted to study and adhere to and follow the life of Yeshua, that Palestinian day laborer, and those who wanted merely to revel in the gory, nasty, disgusting aspects of his ignoble death. Guess who won? Yeah, the death crowd. Funny how that works. And so everybody wanders around, and you get a couple of hundred years of persecution by the Romans, who were more than happy to accommodate. I mean, this is a nation state that crucified 5,000 people, one every half mile or so, all the way from the boot of Italy all the way to Rome on the Appian Way. This was not an issue for them. Oh, you want to be crucified? But we can work that out. We got lots of wood. Yeah, they won. And consequently, in the year 2010 of the current era, some perhaps 1,983 years, or 77 years, math on the fly, my flaw, after the crucifixion of Yeshua, you got Franklin Graham saying that nobody will let him pray. He just wants to pray. See, that's the beautiful thing. Yeshua was existing in a time of great real persecution. Land was occupied by the Romans, you know, on a whim. They could decide who could pray when and how. And they had them a state religion. Every now and then you'd have to go and bow and scrape before an image of the emperor because he was divine. Mm-hmm. And that was a real thorn in the side, this being Thorn in the Side Thursday. That was a real thorn in the side of your devout and observant Jews who had this graven image problem. And it led to serious heartache and bloodshed. Really did. See, that's what happens when you have a state religion. Sooner or later, somebody else's ox, no, not their ox, their ass, is going to get gored when you've got a state religion. But Yeshua lived in that environment. And therefore, looking at the world in which he lived, in which there was manifest misery, suffering all around him, horrible disease, people starving, not nearly enough to eat, and yet the rich seem to be doing quite well, thank you very much. Lo and behold, it was the rich who were standing out in the streets hollering, "Oh God, we adore thee! We follow thy laws! Love thou us! Amen!" And it's not a real reach for someone with any degree of the perspicacity at all to look around and go, "This ain't working." Everybody talks about giving to the widows and the orphans. Everybody talks about the need to be good to each other. And they pray unceasingly in the streets, and that ain't working either. Maybe we need to be doing it on the down low, in quiet, in secret. And that way, if you're doing your praying in secret, the Romans can't run you through with one of those incredibly effective little short swords. That was real persecution. Not letting you violate the law, Franklin Graham, and proselytize and talk about how your God is the only God does not constitute persecution of you, Sirrah. Not by a long shot. No, no. Not even. So, I guess that's where the evening begins. It is certainly not where it ends. We have hardly scratched the surface of Rent Boy Reeker. It's astonishing when you see stories about people like George Rentboy Reeker, who has written supposedly phony baloney, well, what he passes off, tries to pass off as scholarship, but turns out to be phony baloney snake oil, about curing the homosexuals of their urge to be homosexual, and then gets caught hiring a rent boy. Honest to God, I had no idea he was a homosexual. He just seemed like a nice boy. Give the best back rubs? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hired him to carry my bag. Yeah. So, that is where we begin this evening, with Franklin Graham on the National Day of Prayer, wherein I've tried to follow the news through the course of the day, but it's been difficult. But wherein, as far as I can tell, my chosen deity, namely the Flying Spaghetti Monster, has not been offered the respect and worship of which he is clearly deserving, seeing how he did create the universe first. Remember, faithful, he started by making a mountain, a tree, and a dwarf. Yes. And no one prayed to the Flying Spaghetti Monster on Capitol Hill today. And I mean to tell you, brethren and sistren, I feel persecuted over it. I don't think there was a single individual at that National Day of Prayer dressed like a pirate. And how we can expect the Flying Spaghetti Monster to continue to bless us with his noodly appendages when there wasn't so much as a single person dressed as a pirate at the National Day of Prayer. Well, it plumb evades me. Indeed. Not once did any of those people gathered at that National Day of Prayer even so much mutter any, not one yar. Not one. How can America call itself blessed when it lives in such a state of benighted darkness as to do such manifest disrespect to His noodly goodness? I do not know. So as I said, that is where we begin this evening. There are many other places in directions in which we shall go. I welcome your calls to 877-443-2366, 877 the numeral 4 head on. It's not prayer meeting Wednesday, but it is the National Day of Prayer, and it's the National Day of Prayer right here on the horn too, brethren and sistren. So do not hide your light under a bushel. Amen and amen. Somebody pass me a snake and a shot glass of strychnine. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is the horn.
Give to me my time and money. Give to me my milk and honey. Give to me my self-respect. Golden chains around my neck. Give to me my supermodel. Corporate jet and champagne bottles. Get me out there on the town. Let me spread my wealth around. I could learn to love this life I lead. Just don't take away the things I need. I feel rosy in the pink, so just don't make me stop and think. All those dark thoughts in my head seem like better left unsaid. Give it to me. Give it to me. Burn with passion. Give to me my charm and wit. Keep my body young and fit. Give to me my haute couture. Give the world a cancer cure. Serve my breakfast al fresco. Let the wine and liquor flow. I can search for truth some other time, but right now I just wanna get what's mine. Let the gangsters rule. Try to make ends meet. I despise all bleeding hearts. I don't patronize the arts. Give it to me. Give it to me. Give it to me. Right now.
I don't understand what it is you're trying to sell me, or what it is you're trying to tell me. Trying to get me to show some compassion. Man, that's so out of fashion.
Give to me my Aspen winner. Sorry about the World Trade Center. I can't help the ones in need. I got my own mouth to feed. Give to me my Playboy channel. Some killer weed and sheets of flannel. Lay me down upon my bed with pleasant dreams to fill my. Look at what this world is coming to. And there ain't one damn thing that I can do. I don't have a leg to stand on. I don't have a net to land on. I don't have the space of power. I don't have the extra hour. Give it to me. Give it to me. Give it to me. Outsourced, build me my own private golf course. The Dixie chicks can kiss my ass, but I still need that backstage pass. Give to me my NASDAQ numbers, Intel shells, and E-Trade blunders. I have soldiers to defend my freedom, and I strip for value if I need them. And give it to me. Thank you.
Rodney Crowell. How? That, by the way, friends and neighbors, is the obscenity prayer from Rodney Crowell's 2005 release, The Outsider. Oh, I think that one goes into standard rotation. I just do. I do, I do, I do. Let's see if there's anybody on the line here. Got two blinking lights. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. You got Dave in Northern California.
Hey, what's happening, Dave?
Well, I wanted to update you because when last we spoke, you mentioned that you have some listeners that are pretty high-tech and that wanted to get involved in my predicament. That is that I'm still not permitted on any chat room. I'm still not now permitted to listen to your radio station. If I want to listen at all, I have to call you and hope that you leave me on hold long enough to get a gist of what you're about. I am no longer able to sign up for any kind of an email. I've got several of them I'm working on. I'm even gone to Juneau.
Well, I tell you what, I've been looking for an email from you. I have not received one.
If I go to the library, if I go to the senior center, if I go to the community center, I am not permitted to send an email to my friend Bob Kincaid. It just isn't going to be allowed to happen. That's being blocked at every turn. And if necessary, they'll even shut the damn computer down in the library. So,
Dave, I got to tell you, this is
sounds crazy.
No, there are technical explanations for every problem relating to a computer. Now, I have a lot of problems here from time to time. For instance, I wasn't on the air last night because, well, every time I see a telephone truck on my road, I know things are going to go south for me. But that's because we have shitty infrastructure, okay? It's not because the federal government's eating me, okay? If anything, Barack Obama would want this out there, even though I'm sometimes critical of him. I am far more critical of the right wing. So there's a good reason for having me out there and for having you listening. It's really not the right forum to say what kind of computer do you have, what kind of processor, what kind of operating system, all of that stuff. But I assure you, if you go to the library and you set up a Gmail account, and you send an email to me from that Gmail address, and you send it to bobkincaid@gmail.com, I'll get it, and I will, as God is my witness, pass it along.
Well, Bob, I think that you're one person that I would believe would be open to the possibility that these Patriot Act troopers that I'm dealing with are not beneath going well beyond whatever freedom... You've heard it in the news before, how AT&T get actively involved in being a part of it. It isn't the Barack Obama versus Bush administration or even Clinton. This is a part of our government agency that's...
Yeah, but why you, Dave?
Why me?
Yeah, I mean, I'm far more dangerous.
I know you are, but let me tell you...
If that's what it was, then they would have shut down Malloy years ago. He wouldn't be able to so much as play a hand of solitaire on a computer.
Well, you're making good logical sense. It would seem to me, for one thing, I am a relatively harmless little old guy up here in Northern California that shouldn't worry about it. I'll tell you why it happened to me. Do you want to hear it?
Sure.
All right. I had stumbled into one big major corporate government fraud. It was a corporation paying off all the Democrats and Republicans buying the right to do their thing, which was, in fact, through their clients without any accountability. That is no fraud agency, no congressman, no senator, no Democrat or Republican would take a look at this problem. It involved the Travelers Express Company, the Viad Corporation, and that's a long story there, and I don't need to get into it. Just that they had a big corporate government fraud. They were ripping off their customers for $500 a whack. However, and I couldn't get any Democrat or any Republican or any agency in the United States to take any look at this. They had been bought. However, the Travelers Express did business worldwide. So I took the time to write up my story of what had happened. And I sent it to every member of parliament, every prime minister that I could think of, in Scotland, in England, in Ireland, in Belgium, in Australia. Almost all of them they did respond. Unlike the American politicians, they took it seriously. They sent letters to the FBI, to the Attorney General, to anybody that, saying, would you please look into what this man is alleging and report back to me? Well, I'll tell you now, Bob, I have never been alone on a computer from that day forward. I made friends all over the world with these agencies, but they didn't ever want me to have any further contact with them. So that's when it all happened. Am I still with you?
You're right here.
Okay, well, several members of Parliament tried to follow it up, but they were not allowed to do so. And now they assign goons that are not beneath abusing their power just in the most ridiculously stupid way. Yes, if I wanted to play a game of checkers or chess on the book, they'll mess with that. If I wanted to send an email to a friend, they'll mess with that. Why? Nothing. No reason. As a certainty, I am not an international terrorist. I am not a criminal. And the Patriot Act people, they got this power because they were supposedly fighting crime on the Internet. They're not fighting crime. They are the crime. So.
Well, Dave, I still say, if you go to the library.
I've gone to the library.
And you go and you get yourself a Gmail account, Google Mail.
All right.
Because remember, their motto is, don't do evil.
Gmail?
Yeah. Get a Gmail account and send me.
Isn't Google doing it? No, it isn't that. Yeah. All right, I will make it a try with Google. I don't know that I've done it with Google. I've been trying.
Just get a Gmail account.
I've been trying it with Yahoo. I've been trying it with Hotmail. And they're not going to let me send an email to you.
I have a feeling, David, has everything to do with the computer you're running and nothing to do with federal goons. I just really, really do.
God, I wish I could share your faith in government.
No, it's not my faith in government. It's my lack of faith in old computer processors.
Now, you don't think I've been trying this in the senior center and at the my local library at the Humboldt County?
Yeah, but
library.
A lot of these places have firewalls.
And they won't allow me to sign up and send an email?
They won't allow you to stream media because it's a bandwidth eater.
Oh no, they let you stream. They normally would. They normally let you listen to. They give you headphones if you want them in the library. And if you want to listen to music or radio, they will let you do that.
Well, I'll bet you if you'll get an email to me, every time you mention this, I get an email from people out there in California saying, "I want to help Dave. I want to help Dave. It's a simple solution. We can fix it. It's not a problem. I want to help Dave."
Okay, Bob, what I want to do, because at this point I've lost whatever I can lose. I cannot sign up for any kind of a Internet system right now on my own computer. They will interfere with me at my doing so. So I can give you the name of an email, one of my email accounts, and a password, and see if anybody that's listening can get on it and see if there's anything they can do. You want me to try it?
Not over the air, no. Because I have a feeling you have corruptions in your system enough as it is.
So I tell you what.
Let me put you back on hold. Don't hang up.
All right.
And when I go to a break, I will come back to you. I will get the information from you, and I will share it with someone trustworthy whom I will bet will get you going.
God bless you if you can do it, my friend. Roll out.
I bet you we can. Dave, take care.
I will definitely
stay on hold. Don't hang up, okay?
I'm on.
All right. Talk to you later, Dave. Okay, and we will try this line. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello, are you talking with me, Bob?
I am.
Bob, my name is Steve Pease. I think you were scheduled to interview me about a half an hour ago.
Yes, I was, and I thought we were doing this Tuesday.
Well, look, if you'd rather do it on Tuesday, we'll see if we can make it happen then.
Well, no, can we just move it about 30 minutes, Steve?
Sure. You want to call me or have me call you?
I will give you a call, and I apologize. I've got this thing calendared into next week, but this is wonderful.
Give me a buzz in a half an hour. I'll just sit here.
Okay, and I will do that. Steve, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye now. Well, okay. I need a producer. I really, really do.
We will be having a conversation with Steve Pease here in about 30 minutes. He is an author, and he is the author of a magnificent book. I know it is a magnificent book because I have it here before me. It is called The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement, The Compendium of Culture, People, and Their Stunning Performance, the achievements of the Jewish people in America. It's a magnificent, well-documented book, and it is being extremely well-received. And we will have that conversation in about a half an hour. Okay? Good. So let's do this real quick. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, I haven't called in a while, but it's Brian from New Hampshire.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
How are you? I'm trying to hang in there. I got some other problems with cleaning up from storm damages up here from windstorms in the late part of the winter up here in early spring. But it's nothing compared to what, God love them, what the people of the Gulf of Mexico are going through, what the, you know, that with that Gulf Stream, the way it could come up around.
And what the folks in Nashville are dealing with.
And the folks in Nashville and the 29 miners dead before that because of that bastard and those unregulated mines in your own West Virginia there. It's a horrible, this corporatism, this libertarianism, this sheer profiteering and trying to pass it off as really, truly, honestly earned income. It's got to end. This sickness that started it with it was given full force, and he was heavily influenced, Ronald Reagan was, by Milton Friedman and Ayn Rand and the likes of Alan Greenspan, who gets away with the biggest tax increase in American history, the Social Security tax, and then the Republicans steal from it. Instead of Al Gore's Social Security lockbox, they steal from it its annual surpluses, or we wouldn't even have if Al Gore had taken his duly elected presidency in early 2001, we wouldn't even have this Social Security so-called crisis or these huge deficits in debt that we've now had thanks to George W. Bush and these damn Republicans and these damn corporations. And now they're going to kill off a lot of life on this planet. It could be a huge swath of it with what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico. Apparently what Halliburton was doing, the project on that's very well that blew up there right just before or just as it blew up.
Yes, they were. They did the concrete work.
Oh, that's as much like the work in Iraq where they electrocute American service people there. You know,
That's the first thing I thought of, Brian, the minute that I saw that Halliburton had worked on that thing. But yeah, you know what? You want a little piece of trivia to just stoke the, and I'm not referring to you, I'm referring to me,
yeah,
to just really fan the flames of paranoia? I got one for you. You know where Dick Cheney is?
He's in Saudi Arabia.
You're damn right he's in Saudi Arabia. Now the guy has no power. The guy is not he's not the head of Halliburton anymore.
Corporate, so-called American corporate media has been giving him lots of power over the last months from day one of Obama's administration to criticize everything this president does, basically. He hasn't killed enough innocent Afghans, apparently, to make us more safe and secure. He hasn't tortured enough people.
And that's tough, because we've been killing innocent Afghans for all we're worth, Brian.
That's right. I couldn't get that's I've got my own problems with it. I think he did that offshore drilling thing a few months back to okay it. It was kind of the sucker the Republicans in to force them to go along with his other overall climate bill and the rest because he knew those contracts wouldn't go through and the actual work on those oil drillings wouldn't happen until many years in the future. But it's still, I hope that I hope it's begun to wake him up or really completely woken him up like it has Governor Schwarzenegger, at least in California. He's got enough sanity and enough brain cells left that hasn't been affected by the steroids in his film career that he knows California has one of the most beautiful coastlines too and on the planet, not just in the country. And he's not allowing the drilling off there. This whole thing though, I'm sure you've heard about the Mike Papantonio interviews there where he's a great environmental activist and he's from that area of Pensacola, Florida, or that panhandle, a real southern guy, but a real good lawyer too for the people. And he's saying just that $500,000 acoustic sensor, just that where that could have prevented invented all of this, according to what he's saying, and other people too. I guess they're more technically, you know, hept on the on that subject. But it just the whole thing. You know, the only thing I can think of, I know Halliburton was involved in a drilling an accident. It was about another, exactly almost another year ago, a year before this one, off the Timor Sea, I believe it's north of Australia. Halliburton was involved in an oil platform disaster there, too. The only good thing about it there was it looks to be, I'm looking at my Oxford Atlas maps there, that it was more shallow water that happened, and this is a real deep sea a drilling platform that's completely imploded, and you know, the not just the 11 workmen there, that but the, you know, it just the huge hole in Mother Earth has been made, apparently. Do you believe that this beyond petroleum? I don't get the fact that it's British petroleum too. I just it's not just my Irish Catholic forebears that are trying to get me more angry about this, but it's just the fact that it's the way they tried. It's nothing to do with British. I love England. I'm just was watching a movie about World War II, and that's what got me onto calling you about Bridge Too Far. You know, about the British led forces and Montgomery's crazy idea to go up a bridge too far, the bridge in Arnhem in Holland in World War II, late 1944. And it gets back to me thinking about it. Well, this is we're the Anglo-American inheritors of the British Empire, which were the inheritors basically of the Roman Empire. And you know, we're is that all we're just become? You know, that just like Chalmers, Johnson's, and all this book about blowback and all that. Is all this like the torture? Just everybody down deep, subconsciously at least they know it. They may not want to admit it verbally, but we have been torturing these innocent Muslim men in order to make more enemies, in order to gin up this war against Al Qaeda, which to compare them as an enemy, again, to compare them to the Cold War enemy, the Soviet Union, or the World War II enemy of Nazi Germany, it's insane. This and the trillions we're spending on all of this, when it could go to basically a Manhattan Project for alternative energy, could easily have solved this and prevented this.
Brian,
in the Gulf of Mexico.
Brian, you can't look at any of this without thinking back to Jimmy Carter's speech in 1977.
Oh yes.
Talking about our hopeless dependence on oil.
Absolutely, a great man.
And you know,
the first thing he did, Ronald Reagan took the solar panels off the
bingo
White House.
And that was just a big old telegraphed message to the petroleum industry that they were back in the chair. And I don't mean the electric chair where some of them belong. But the fact of the matter, you got Cheney flying off presumably holding hands with the king of Saudi Arabia and walking through the bluebells. I don't know if bluebells grow in Saudi or not. And at the same time, Brian, here's another fun one to add into the stew. I don't know if you saw this or not. CNN and MSNBC have gladly taken, money paid to do so by votevets.org. To run an ad arguing for exactly what you were talking about, a clean energy climate plan to cut our dependence on foreign oil.
Yep.
And they go so far as to say a clean energy climate plan would cut our dependence on foreign oil in half and cut oil profits for hostile nations. That's what the ad says. Well, CNN took the money and ran it. MSNBC took the money and ran it. Fox News said the ad was too confusing and refused to run it. I'm not kidding. They said it was too confusing.
Like syllables for them. No.
You know why it was confusing? You know why it was confusing, Brian? It was confusing because they couldn't decide whether they wanted the money or whether they wanted to do the bidding of the majority minority stockholder in News Corp.
Oh, my God.
We do remember who the majority minority...
Right. Yeah.
The Saudis.
The Arabian government, the royal family there. That is the Bush Saudi royal family there. You know, remember George Sr. Poppy was having breakfast with one of the Bin Laden's own brother there on the morning of September 11th, and the ISI, that's like the head of the CIA of Pakistan, was in with Senator Bob Graham and the Porter Goss there, the intelligence committees that he had in the House. And Graham did in the Senate, and on the morning of September 11th, he was briefing them on something, and he was the guy that allegedly wired $100,000 to Muhammad Atta just before those attacks in September 2001. There's so much more in this that it's just I think it's even, going by this Bridge Too Far movie, there was a British-led mad operation by General Montgomery. He did great in the desert warfare in World War II. He helped American in the West, the Allies' morale there against Rommel, but he fought back brilliantly against Rommel there in the North Africa, but that was not there in Holland there. It was more than a bridge too far. It was madness. But just to say, I think what's happened now, post-September 11th, even the British MI5 or the most secretive of the Israeli spy services, they've got nothing on whoever the people were that did September 11th. That's all. It's sad but true. I love World War II movies because it was a more innocent time. It's not just my beloved father. He fought there in World War II, Italy, etc. But it was our last good war. I mean, there were some good parts to the Cold War, of course. There were some good parts even to driving Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait in the first Gulf War, in spite of they didn't need to lie with that Kuwaiti princess there, the son of the diplomat there, about the Iraqi soldiers were stealing incubators from thousands or hundreds of Kuwaiti
babies. Oh, yeah.
Any hospital doesn't even have more than a couple of dozen at the most of those incubators at any one time, but it makes absolutely no sense, the logistical sense for their, as far as caregivers, for them to have anything like hundreds of incubators in one hospital. But I'll let you go there, Bob. I think what one wonderful part I'll just leave you with from this movie is it's not only a bridge too far. I think it was like a movie too long, you could call it, by about 40 or 45 minutes.
That too.
Some of the scenes, but there was a wonderful, charming scene there. That 14-year-old Dutch boy there, he's spying on the Germans, and they show one scene there where he's 14 and. That's just because he's a kid. It's not just because the Dutch or Germanic people like the German, but when I visited Holland in the 1980s, they still couldn't get over their hatred of the Germans and any big country that invades its neighbors. It's same Scotland and England, Scotland and Ireland, any bullies against the smaller nations around them, that there's always going to be some bad blood from that. Americans doesn't seem to learn from the history of Europe, but the fact is, this young Dutch kid there, the German soldier was saying that, because General Model, the Field Marshal Model, was right there, his big staff car, those fancy Mercedes car there, and the Dutch kid was saying to him, she's my girlfriend, and it's her birthday, and it's my birthday, and she wants to give me a present that I've got. He says, go, be quick, and he lets him go, but he manages to spy that he sees the flag, the special flag for the Field Marshal Model was there in Arnhem. In Arnhem, and Dutch intelligence tried to warn Montgomery that the Germans had a lot more powerful forces up there around Arnhem than the British intelligence was giving them credit for.
Well, indeed, and by the way, speaking of, wow, this makes me sound simple, Brian, but speaking of World War II books with the name Bridge in them, my favorite read along those lines is the brilliant work done by my former congressman Ken Heckler,
okay.
who wrote The Bridge at Remagen.
Oh, all right. Oh, that was a pretty good movie too. That was a George Carlin. No.
Did I lose you, Brian? I think I lost Brian. It's going to be an interesting night. By the way, I've checked my schedule. I'm pretty. I wouldn't say I've got a photographic memory, but I'm pretty close. And I did check my schedule. We were on for, Mr. Pease and I were on for Tuesday, evening. But you know what? This is as good a time as any. And by Jove, we will have the conversation. You know what we're going to do? We are going to, take a little break, and it'll just about take up all the time that I need to, get Mr. Pease back on the air. We will be discussing the golden age of Jewish achievement because May is National Jewish Heritage Month in the United States. And this is a beautiful book, annotated like crazy. This is a humongous, this is a piece of scholarship. I don't know if a piece of scholarship like this has been done before. I will confess to you, I read every book that I do an interview on. And I had budgeted myself until Tuesday to get square with this. I'm about halfway through, so I apologize if I am not fully informed on the content of the book. But just what a history geek I am. This thing just grabs you and goes. And just reading through and all the accomplishments and the struggle. How can you not admire it? You know what I mean? So we will take a little break, and then we will come back. You are listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You are, in fact, listening to the horn. And a little National Day of Prayer music coming along from John Fox for your enjoyment, followed by the Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. This is Alice in Chains, God Am, on the horn.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, May 6th, 2010.
The latest on the disaster in the Gulf. One leak contained, another dome in position. Other things happening that aren't in the Gulf. Plus,
they played politics with this crisis.
Playing politics with disaster in the Gulf.
All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
BP has shut off one of the three oil leaks. Now they just have to take care of the premium and super leaks.
This is your Green News Report.
At least it's not foreign oil.
Green News Report is sponsored by you, our listeners. Yes, you. Please stop by our website, greennews.bradblog.com, and hit that PayPal button so that we can afford to continue bringing you the most feisty green news, politics, and analysis you'll find on the mainstream media. We rely on your support. Stop by bradblog.com today, hit the PayPal button, and send your vote for the Green News Report to continue. Okay, Desi Doyen, is it just me, or between the recent mine disaster, the oil disaster, storms in the South, is the regular news starting to sound more like the Green News Report, or is the Green News Report starting to sound more like the regular news?
I think it's both.
Well, it's about damn time. Too bad it took so many disasters to make that happen.
Well, before we get to the latest in the Gulf, a few quick headlines. MIT has introduced a prototype solar cell that can be printed on paper. That's a solar cell with a printer. On paper.
Cool. Really?
Yep, really. Floodwaters are slowly beginning to recede in Nashville. 29 people were killed and 5 are still missing after torrential rainstorms. The mayor of Nashville says damage estimates could top $1 billion.
The scenes from the flooding there are just extraordinary.
The U.S. reduced its carbon emissions by 7% in 2009 due to the recession and greater energy efficiency. According to the U.S. Energy Information Agency, the 7% reduction is already halfway to meeting the U.S. pledge at the Copenhagen Climate Summit and also contained in climate legislation in Congress.
If we can just go into a depression, we'll clean up this entire planet.
And speaking of climate legislation, Senator John Kerry says that comprehensive clean energy and climate legislation could be introduced as early as next Monday in the Senate, regardless of whether Republican Senator Lindsey Graham supports the bill.
That would be good to hear. I've been asking where the hell are the Democrats and Obama calling for climate legislation given this disaster in the Gulf. Harry Reid was asked whether the oil spill in the Gulf would adversely affect climate legislation. He said, on the contrary, I think it should spur it on. I say, you think it should spur it on? You're the majority leader. Spur it, Harry Reid.
And now on to the latest of the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. BP has admitted in a closed-door briefing with members of Congress on Wednesday that they could be underestimating the amount of oil spilling from the broken wellhead. Potentially, it could be as much as 60,000 barrels instead of the 5,000 barrels currently estimated. That's based on government records of daily output at other producing deepwater wells. But even the Coast Guard has said it's impossible to get more than a very rough estimate at such depths with zero visibility. While BP struggles to find a way to cap that well, the political spinning has already begun. Some Republicans are saying the oil spill shows we need even more offshore drilling, and some are accusing the Obama administration of responding too slowly to the unfolding disaster. Michael Brown, the infamous director of FEMA during Hurricane Katrina, proposed his theory on Fox News.
This president has never supported big oil, he's never supported offshore drilling, and now he has an excuse to shut it back down.
This president has never supported big oil or offshore drilling.
Heck of a lie, Brownie.
One lawyer for families of workers killed in the initial explosion accuses BP of withholding critical information on the true extent of the spill from the Coast Guard. Now, Republican congressmen are calling for congressional investigations into the administration's response and oversight by the Minerals Management Service. The New York Times reports this week that BP was specifically exempted from an environmental review after the Bush administration's Minerals Management Service downplayed the odds of a major spill because deep water rig technology was believed to be so sophisticated that a spill was just about inconceivable.
Could that exemption have had anything to do with the fact that Bush MMS officials were having sex and drug parties with the industry lobbyists?
Oh, maybe.
Maybe? Just maybe. All right.
So the good news with the oil spill is that the weather is helping to keep that oil slick about 5 miles offshore for the most part, which is really good news for the marshes. It's allowing controlled burns to again be deployed. Mother Jones reports that neither BP nor the federal government had special fire containment booms anywhere on hand in the Gulf at all, even though it was called for in a 1994 oil spill response plan, apparently because the idea of a huge oil spill in the Gulf was apparently inconceivable.
Who could have foreseen it?
And the dome that is being lowered today to cover the second leak was manufactured after the oil spill because BP apparently didn't think they would need it. The idea of an oil spill in the Gulf was apparently inconceivable.
Yes, it was inconceivable. Dick Cheney helped exempt the industry from making these preparations exactly. This is not Obama's Katrina. This is, as our friend and blogger Skippy the Bush Kangaroo says, Cheney's Chernobyl. Read much more about the oil spill and the other stories we didn't get to today at our website, greennews.bradblog.com. Download us anytime on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, listen to us on your mobile device via Stitcher Radio. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Under the sea, under the sea. Darling, it's better down where it's wetter. Take it from me. Up on the shore, they work all day. Out in the sun, they slave away. While we be boating, full time, you floating under the sea.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention
$24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Minutes past the hour. This is the Horn. I'm Bob, and this is the halfway mark in the program. And let me tell you, a long time ago, you know, I fooled around in theater a little bit here and there, and I once knew a juggler. And the old juggler looked at me one time when I said, you know, how do you do it? And he said, son, the key to all this is if you drop something, make it look like part of the act. And so and so it is that things went a little sideways last night with technical stuff, And this evening, I'm really, really tickled. It sort of happened al fresco, as it were. But on the line with me right now, or coming on the line in just a moment, a gentleman and author by the name of Stephen Pease. He is the author of a magnificent new book. Like I said, I'm about halfway through it, called The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement. May is, of course, Jewish Heritage Month in the United States, and this is a tremendous way to mark it. It is a I don't know if this book, anything like this book, has ever been done. Just quantifying the tremendous achievements and the tremendous gifts that the Jewish people have given to the United States over the course of a relatively short span of time. So without further blathering on my part, let's get Mr. Pease onto the program and find out a little bit behind the book, about the book, within the book. And since I haven't finished it yet, he won't give away the surprise ending. Mr. Pease, welcome to the program. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Bob, thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It is a joy, as is the book. Let's start, if you don't mind, at the beginning with the basic question. Why'd you write it?
As you probably know, because you read the beginning of the book, I'm not Jewish. I'm in fact born and raised Presbyterian, although I wouldn't say I grace the doors of Sunday services very often these days. But I spent a fair amount of my life when I was younger with Jewish friends and Jewish acquaintances, but it culminated with 6 years that I lived and worked in Miami, Florida, for a company that was Jewish started. The guy who was my boss that hired me was Jewish. The people who reported to me was Jewish. The attorneys we used for acquisitions were Jewish. The companies we acquired were Jewish. This was the real estate information business in the 70s, which provided brokers and title companies and appraisers with information about real property all over the U.S. So for 6 years, my life was shaped and involved with an awful lot of Jewish people, and it was delightful. I mean, we fought. We had great friendships. We debated. It was a kind of an indoctrination period for me. And in fact, to this day, a number of my closest friends come out of that part of the experience. Now, through that, I had this intuitive sense that developed that if I could ask somebody to give me a list of the 100 most accomplished symphony conductors, of the 100 greatest mathematicians, and I could identify which amongst them were Jewish, I would discover that they were all out of proportion to their numbers. But I didn't really have the time or the money to dig into it, and the tools didn't exist until about 2002, when a family member of mine became ill, and as a result, I couldn't take on a full-time assignment as a turnaround CEO anymore. So I began to do a little digging on the Internet, and by that time, the Internet was just an astonishing repository, which not only gave me the list and gave me the names of the people on the list, but also allowed me to kind of dig behind it to find out which amongst them might be Jewish. And my purpose was never to out people who didn't want to be outed, but instead just to be able to see what I would find. And a friend of mine who is Jewish, an entrepreneur, found out I was doing this. He and I shared a lunch. I showed him a spreadsheet, and lo and behold, he was an acquaintance of Rabbi Harold Kushner, the fellow who wrote When Bad Things Happen to Good People many years ago. And Kushner took an interest in it, tried to see if his publisher would publish it or an agent that he knew would be the agent. And he said, you know, Steve, I think when you finish this research in terms of the disproportionate achievement, you will prove your point more than you expect, which is true. But he said, for you, Steve, the more intriguing question, I think, is going to be, why do you think this has happened? And that's what chewed up more time. Now, mind you, this was not a full-time project for me because I'm involved in the community of Sonoma, and I'm involved in Russia, have been for many years. So this was one of those things that you do after dinner until you go to bed many nights. And as I told my wife, it's cheaper than belonging to a golf club. So in the end, I finished up with a book. Kushner and a number of other people really gave it an endorsement. And so it got published last November. And as you probably know, this being Jewish American Heritage Month, it seems like a timely period to do a bit of the talking about it and what's involved in it. So that's how I got here.
And, you know, I think that question that you posited, Mr. Pease, is absolutely integral to this, because we're talking about a history of achievement in the United States that while there was a Jewish presence in the U.S. In the colonial days, it really, really blossoms beginning along about the mid-19th century. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it as essentially there was three waves of major Jewish immigrants, but the first major wave was 23 Jews that arrived in 1654 from Brazil. They were being chased by the Inquisition. They had to come someplace safe. They arrive in New Amsterdam, and they get permission to stay, and they insist then that they're going to be a part of the community, and they're going to help defend it. Jews helped to finance the Revolutionary War. They were here through all that period. The oldest synagogue, I believe, is in Rhode Island, and that congregation still exists in Manhattan. Second major wave was mostly German Jews who came out from 1800 to about 1860, and they came because there was moves for democratic and religious freedom in Germany, and things didn't work out the way everybody hoped, and so a lot of them came here. And a lot of those German Jews are how we got our major department stores in the United States, were that group that emigrated. But by far the biggest group came from about 1880 to about 1924, particularly when the Pale of Russia, which involved a lot of Russia, but a lot of Poland, a lot of what we now think of as Lithuania and the Baltic countries, Jews lived in a very, very difficult circumstance there. They were vilified, hated. The pogrom, to the extent any, you know the term, the pogroms occurred there when the Cossacks and others would take out after the Jews. And ultimately, the idea for the Jews was they were either going to get killed, or they're going to leave, or they're going to convert. And so 2 million of them chose to leave and come to the United States in that roughly 24-year period. And that's where the biggest wave came from. And they came here mostly illiterate. Schools had been almost non-existent, except perhaps a little bit in Lithuania. But within a generation, their kids were more than 20% of the student population at Harvard University. They were 40% at Columbia. They were 80% at Hunter College. That drive and thirst for learning and for education was really manifested when you saw what happened in that generation.
And there's also a background, the rabbinical scholarship that pre-exists in the culture, in the European culture, whether it be Ashkenazic or Sephardic or whatever, that sort of transfers into a more secularized academic drive, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the book is called The Golden Age because the Golden Age is roughly the period from 1800 until now. It's really the last 200-plus years. But the story goes back more than that. And in the end, the surprise ending you're going to get is that I think this is mostly a cultural phenomenon, the culture of Jews. And that's a tribal phenomenon as well as a religious phenomenon. But the point is they were the first tribe of people in the history of the world to make education mandatory. And they did that when the Romans were dispersing them all over the planet after the war that the Jews and the Romans had after the time of Christ, roughly from 70 AD when the Second Temple was destroyed to 165 AD after the big fight when ultimately about 1 million Jews were killed by the Romans and they were dispersed. Now, if you've got a people that are going to be spread out all over the planet and they'll be small minorities wherever they are, they've got to be able to know what their tradition, what their history, everything about themselves. And so the rabbinical scholars that took over the religion not only canonized or made, put together the final version of what they call the Tanakh and what I call the Old Testament, but they also took the oral law, which was, they could not put it in writing until the rabbinical scholars said, we have to do this. And so they took all of the oral law, everything else that Moses learned when he was up on the mountain, in addition to what came down in the form of the Ten Commandments and the Tanakh, they put that in writing. And if you're going to put it in writing, you can distribute it all over the planet, but it doesn't do any good unless everybody can read it, debate it, discuss it. So they made education mandatory for what was then a tribe of mostly farmers. You know, literacy was not exactly something that made a lot of sense. What you're doing is bringing in the crops at night. But they made that mandatory in a way that even 1,000 years later, Maimonides is saying that any family that doesn't educate its kids, any community that doesn't have schools, should be banished from the Jewish faith. And so it was always, always, always treasured. And what happened was that through the period from, you know, the time of the diaspora until 1800, they were mostly put upon wherever they existed, Spain, Italy, South America, Germany, Russia, whatever. But about 1800, there was a movement to have an emancipation of Jews that kind of began in Central Europe, but really got pushed by Napoleon. Napoleon really took this as something that was important, and so he made the Jewish emancipation very, very important. And what part of what that ended up doing was that Christians for the first time said, look, we no longer are going to force you to convert. You can live side by side with us, and that's going to allow you to have voting powers. You can come to the schools. You can be in the military. You can be elected to public office. It took almost 100 years, but it happened. And when that happened, all of a sudden, the Jewish talent and intellectual capability could move into secular fields. And as it moved into secular fields, you began to see them in math. I mean, they were always doing some things, but it was trivial compared to what happened after the emancipation, the Jewish Enlightenment, the English Enlightenment, the Reform Movement. All of a sudden, you see them so that, you know, when the Nobel Prizes begin, which is about 1901, you begin to see the Jews become significant in it. And as of today, about 22-23% of all the Nobel Prizes ever awarded has gone to a group of people that are 0.2% of the world population. If you had a room of 1,000 people representing all the world's population, only 2 people out of that 1,000 would be Jewish. But they picked up 23% of the Nobel Prizes, 27% since the Holocaust wiped out a third of their numbers. So as they moved into these secular domains, you begin to see all this talent really begin to flourish.
You mentioned the tribal qualities or the ethnic qualities, however one cares to characterize it, and I'm careful of that, Steve, because that's a double-edged sword, very much so. Because
it's a fair point, Bob, and I don't mean to sound flip. I mean, it's an expression that many Jews use with each other, and probably is one that I should use a little bit more guardedly. But they often think of themselves as tribe, even in their own writings. But the point is, if you look at the Jews, both in Israel and the United States, more of them are secular than are religious. You know, of the roughly 5 to 6 million Jews in the United States, fewer than half of them are you know, Reform Movement or Orthodox Movement or Conservative Movement. Most of them identify as being Jews, and they will fight to the death for their people, but they're not in the synagogue every Saturday attending a service.
Well, but I did want to ask a question along those lines, because I am an inveterate devotee or aficionado of great comedy.
Yep.
And whether it is the Marx Brothers or the Three Stooges, a little more lowbrow, or, you know, you move forward into Jerry, you know, through Henny Youngman and George Burns, up to, you know, Jon Stewart and Jerry Seinfeld. There's that humor streak is there, as well as the academic streak. Is there a Jewishness explanation for phenomena like that?
You know, I don't recall them having said that there's a particular reason. I mean, you can argue about the pathos and all the difficulties that they've lived through, and the value of comedy and humor as a way to kind of handle all the stress and the pressure. And in fact, if you know, some of the Jewish jokes speak to that. You know, all the hardship that they've been through. So, you know, there's a bit of an element that's a reaction to everything that they've been through, you know. And of course, in part, you had the whole Jewish theater on the Lower East Side that existed, particularly amongst those who arrived from the Pale of Russia, and that kind of evolved, you know, to this point. In addition to being great comedians, probably a fourth or so of the great comedians that we've had in the United States, they've also done just astonishing things on Broadway. You know, the bulk of Broadway's longest running musicals were also.
Well, the first motion picture with audio was the story of the son of a disgruntled rabbi, right? I mean, the jazz singer.
To me, that is one of the really interesting stories. And for me, writing it was hard, but one of the most interesting things to write about. Al Jolson was the son of a cantor, which meant he was supposed to not be singing popular songs, and yet as a young man he was singing on the streets of New York, and he was making some money doing it. And he became very well known and very popular. And pretty soon he heard that there was a story that had been written about his life by a chap by the name of Raphaelson. And Raphaelson had the article out. It was very popular. Jolson approached him to see whether or not he might be able to get the rights to that. And Raphaelson, for whatever reason, did not want to see it turned into a big Broadway musical review. But later, Raphaelson turned it into a play. And he didn't have Jolson play in that play, but it became a very popular play on Broadway. About the same time, four brothers called the Warner Brothers were building small small movie studios in Los Angeles and in the East Coast after having run Nickelodeon, Flickers, and having decided that the only way that industry was ever going to really prosper was if they got into producing what we would today call feature-length movies and began renting them out to theaters all over the United States. So they created the Warner Brothers studio. Well, they optioned the rights to this story called The Jazz Singer. And they decided, ultimately, after a wrangle with the guy who had starred in the show on Broadway, that they would have Jolson be the star. So Jolson gets to appear in the movie that is really about his own life, which is also the story of him becoming the entertainer and the fight that he had with his father. Now, there's also a sidebar here. The Warner Brothers, all Jewish, two of them were very religious, two of them were not, and they bought the rights to this movie for totally different reasons. The Orthodox Brothers wanted it to be a story about how the entertainer leaves entertainment and goes back to become a cantor. And the other two wanted it to be a story of assimilation, how this guy becomes a very popular entertainer. So the guys who made the movie, Jack Warner in Los Angeles, who was the assimilationist, changed the ending to make Jolson a very popular entertainer. And that movie came out. It wasn't the very first sound movie, but it was the first significant sound movie, and it revolutionized Hollywood. In the space of 6 months, the idea of putting sound on movies, which is something people had been thinking about and talking about for 20 years, within 6 months, every Hollywood studio was in sound. What most people would not have known, you know, having watched this evolution of sound, was it was really also the story of Jolson, the story of Jewish assimilation, and the Warner Brothers and their assimilation, and it made a bloody fortune for the Warner Brothers. It made them into the studio that we now think of as Time Warner.
And I wonder, because this is another interesting juxtaposition. On the one hand, you have Jolson working in blackface.
Yeah.
And on the other, you have the fact that the civil rights era of the 1960s would not have had many of the qualities and character that it had had it not been for profoundly moved activist young Jewish people inserting themselves into the process. You know, one of them was buried in the earthen dam in Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Yeah, absolutely. If I recall, two of the three kids who went down to get involved in the voters' rights movement, two of the three of them were Jewish, and they were both murdered. So was the black kid. But I mean, Jews founded the NAACP. The officers of the NAACP for most of its early years were Jewish, and they turned it over to the blacks. I think sometime in the late 60s, early 70s. Jews have, you know, Jews have a notion called tikkun olam. Tikkun olam means that they have a duty. They are chosen to help fix a broken world. And amongst the broken problems that they've tried to deal with is racism.
I get the sense, Steve, because you lay this out so well, and this book has, as I said, just absolutely grabbed me. We could do a whole show on the book. Tell me, if you will, please, among all of the achievements that you see having been made in this golden age that you chronicle, does one area or one discipline stand out among others for you?
No, I mean, not a single one. I mean, I think one of them that is worth considering, worth talking a little bit about, is the fact that having lived through so much, having been not permitted to do so, there were industries that they could not join, there were careers that they could not follow. It was very dangerous for them to go into a big company because, well, everybody is, you know, like Germany was the best place for Jews until about 1928. They could do anything. They learned early on that being dependent upon somebody else or on the ups and downs of public mood and public opinion could be a very dangerous thing, which meant you had to be self-supporting. You had to be, you know, it's why they became doctors. If you're a doctor, you live by your skill, and if you're very good, people may not like you, but they're going to use your skill because they know you're very good. It makes you an entrepreneur because you start your own company or you start your own industry. You know, you look at the apparel industry in the United States. It's a small example. You know, the tailors arrived from the Pale of Russia at the time that Isaac Singer, a Jew's sewing machine, begins to be popular. So they create the ready-to-wear industry. I mean, Hollywood, we talked about the Warner Brothers, but every studio in Hollywood was started or largely shaped by Jews, even including Disney. Walt Disney was not Jewish, But Michael Eisner took it over when it was falling on hard times and built it into a powerhouse. Jews were the ones who, because they couldn't move into established situations, often innovated and moved into new industries and created new industries. So I think a big part of this is the power of Jews as entrepreneurs to see an opportunity to do innovative things. In fact, there's a companion book, Startup Nation, by Dan Senor, which is about what's happening in Israel in the last 20 or 25 years, in which that story is told in spades.
To what extent, Steve, has you mentioned working with Jewish lawyers early in the conversation. To what extent have Jews in the legal profession shaped the essential structure of the U.S. legal system itself?
That's a good question. I can't give you the definitive answer. I mean, they've always been involved in law. I mean, you look, for example, at the Supreme Court today. Two of the nine Supreme Court justices are Jews. I looked at the graduates of the law schools at Harvard and Yale and Stanford, which I think of as three high-end law schools, and while you can't identify what every student is, if you look at the names, you'll discover that probably a third or more of those attendees are Jewish, as are the professors. I mean, my guess is amongst the major law firms, you're going to find an incredible number of Jews that are there, in part because they pursue education. In part because of Tikkun Olam, in part because they believe that they have to stand up for what they think is right. You know, look at the United States Senate. 12%, 14% are Jewish, most of them attorneys. That's where the laws are made. And while they're only 2% of the U.S. population, 12% of the U.S. Senate is Jewish.
Does some of this, in a way, sort of from a backhanded sort of methodology, does some of this play into the hands of the anti-Semites? Because at the same time that this golden age is in full flower, say the early part of the 20th century, you've got people like Henry Ford who are repropagating the learned protocols of the Elders of Zion.
It can, but it's exactly the opposite reason this book exists. I mean, the Nobel Prizes are not selected by Jews who are patting each other on the back. They're selected by Norwegians and Swedes, which have an almost non-existent Jewish population. You can't look at what they've accomplished and attribute it to some great conspiracy or some cabal of Jews who are doing this. It is simply a matter of a culture that drives their people to achieve. And the reason I wrote the book is that I think by looking at those cultural phenomena, there's things that we can all learn. We can, as individual groups, I'm kind of a mutt. I'm Scotch, Irish, English, German, and Dutch. I live in a community that has a lot of Latinos in it. There are a lot of Asians. You can look at these groups of people. There's things that we can learn from what the Jews have believed. I mean, for example, the Jews believe it's what you do in this life that matters. From their standpoint, everything you do in this life is what counts, period. It is not a matter of simply expecting that things go round and come round and everything's going to be okay in the next life, or that because you believe a particular thing, you're destined to go to heaven. They believe in a sense of accountability and responsibility.
Yeah, this is not dress rehearsal.
You end up coming away with the idea that the reason people are achieving something is not necessarily just because they're Jewish, but because Jewish culture and values really gives them something to drive for and something to work very hard on. So the reason, I mean, somebody can read this book or look at this book and say, look, you know, these guys, they're getting everything. That's not fair. Well, fair is not what this is about. It's performance is what this is about, and its performance has been driven by their talent and their hard work and their culture.
I think that is stated very well, Steve. When we consider the U.S. going forward, brain going faster than mouth. Do you see this the tailing off or dropping or decreasing this sense of drive as more and more assimilation takes place, or is it as strong in 2010 as it was in 1910?
Five different facets to that to answer. Yes, on two counts, I'm worried about it. I'm worried about it just because Jews are becoming an ever smaller percentage of the world's population. At the end of World War II, they were 0.4% of the world's population. That's after the Holocaust, mind you, when they lost a third of their people. And today they're only 0.2%. So they're half as much of the world's population today as they were, 60, 70 years ago. And further, they are a group of people who tend to marry later in life. They tend to have fewer kids. They often marry outside their tribe, outside their religion, and they tend to assimilate. And even in some elements of their views, they tend to be more integrative. I mean, they've always been able to integrate other people in other cultures, and so there's some risk of dilution of this strong culture. It worries me. But with all that said, these values seem to me to be awfully strong, and where in the beginning, when I was first writing this book, I thought maybe the dissipation of the religious views of the Orthodox Jews and the conservatives and the Reformed Jews might cause it to go down. I became less and less convinced that was true. What I think is key is whether or not these cultural values stay in place. And I have to say I don't have the answer. I'm worried about it because of this decline in the total numbers of Jews. I worry about it because many places, Israel is a small example, they're not growing nearly as... The reason they have kept their numbers in Israel is because of immigration. The wave of immigration is now over. There are no large numbers of Jews to emigrate to Israel anymore. And the rate at which Jews are repopulating is trivial compared to their neighbors. So, the whole demography here, in the long run, is a very interesting challenge for them.
You mentioned, Steve, that easily half and perhaps more of the Jewish population of the United States is secular in nature. Do you think the tradition itself more grounded in the ethnic and all the things that you, all the praiseworthy things that you note in the book, is it more grounded in ethnicity or in religion?
I don't think you can say it's an either or proposition. I think it's really both. But I can't think of very many Jews that are my friends who don't have tremendous pride in their Jewishness. Now, I say that with the qualification that people who have read my book that kind of were only nominally Jewish tell me how much it reignited their pride in being Jewish. But most of the Jews that I have had long friendships with have, even if they don't go to the synagogue, and I don't go to the Presbyterian Church often anymore, they are very proud of their people, they're very aware of their people, they know the good news and the bad news, they debate whether or not everything that's being happening in Israel is the right thing or the wrong thing, but they're not about to disown their history and their tradition. That cultural legacy, which I was using the expression tribe, is very important to them. So I think you'll find, like I say, you go to Israel, and the state of Israel was started mostly by secular Jews at the time, and they've made it into this powerful country. So I'm less concerned that the decline in the religion per se would cause the diminishment. But, all things being equal, I just assume they kept their religion and their cultural values because I think we benefit from that. I mean, you realize that when I was a kid, polio was a scourge. We couldn't go into the public swimming schools in Spokane, Washington because of polio. Well, two Jews, Salk and Sabin, solved that problem. The incidence of polio has diminished almost entirely all over the world because of two Jews. So having a group of people who contributed as much as they have is vitally important for all of us. So I hope they don't kind of lose that. Now, the good news on the other side is that the Asians are coming along and they're beginning to do some things that are very much like it. I think they had maybe several hundred years where they were also put upon, but now they're beginning to really march ahead very well. I mean, at Cal Berkeley, they are becoming the most significant student population. So they're achieving and they're beginning to contribute as well. But I think it's in all of our interests to have high achievement exist and for people to believe that they want to contribute and make a difference in life. And the Jews have been doing it, the Asians have been doing it. But I'm a little worried that the numbers of Jews in the world may diminish with time.
Is it also your hope that in this book, Steve, I hope in the words that I choose that I don't miscast what I mean. There is an element in this country, and I don't mean this from a sexual standpoint, I mean it from the anthropological standpoint, there's an element in this country that fetishizes the Jewish people. And by that I think of Reverend Hagee, with his fundamentalist view of the purpose of the Jews, you know, big air quotation marks around them. The horrible things, you know, not just the Shoah, but also, you know, the pogroms that you mentioned, the things that were done, to Jewish people in Europe, during the Black Death, the rise of the blood libel, the claim that matzah is made from the blood of, Christian babies, Jews poisoned the well and caused the plague and all of that stuff. Is it also your hope to take away some of the fetishization and the victimization of the Jewish people and let them stand on their own to a certain extent?
Well, let me see if I can.
Does that make any sense?
Tell me if it's what you're thinking of. I mean, did I write this because in some small way I'd like to take on anti-Semitism? The answer to that question is yes. I mean, I just think it's stupid ignorance. You know, the blood, they never killed babies for blood to put it in their matzah. They never did anything. You know, usually that story arose because Jews had become educated. They couldn't become farmers. They couldn't go into established industries. They always had to kind of be out there on their own. And they were invited into countries to do the most unpleasant tasks by the rulers, such as collect taxes. And so when times were good, everybody was happy. But when times went bad, who are you going to go after? You're going to go after the scapegoat known as the Jews, and you'll invent 1,000 reasons for it. In my view, anti-Semitism is simply dumb. There are people just like you and me. There's some bad ones like Madoff. There's the guy in Postville, you know, who is running the slaughterhouse. There's crooks on Wall Street that are Jewish. But when I look into it, you don't find that disproportionate to the numbers at all. In fact, generally, there are fewer. So my view was, I'm going to try and tell this story with the good news and the bad news. I'm happy to talk about the number of Jewish spies who helped the Russians get the atom bomb. But you have to also look at everything that they've contributed, and it's just plain astonishing. Now, there's another side to the question that you ask about fetishism, which is some of the conservative Christian faiths are really delighted to see Israel exist and to see the Jews succeed because, in their view, the end days are coming because of that. And so to some extent, these people are great supporters of Israel because they believe it's part of something that's preordained. Now, I'd have to say, as a lapsed Presbyterian, it's not my view of the world, but I can understand why they, you know, are delighted that the Jews are living. The downside, of course, is that they believe that when the rapture arrives, the Jews had better convert.
Yeah, they get to start killing them.
Kind of nonsense.
Yeah, and to the same extent, Steve, that you're a lapsed Presbyterian, I am a recovering Southern Baptist. So all of that pre and post and during millennialist nonsense was crammed down my throat at a very early age, and it was, and you could almost see the twinkle in these fundamentalist Christians' eyes when they talked about when the rapture comes and Jesus and every knee shall bend and every head shall bow, and the ones that don't, that, you know, when the Jews don't, well, then we get to slaughter them. And that is precisely what I was getting at with that question of the fetishization, because you'll forgive me, I hope, if you disagree. That's dangerous stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like it. It's one of the reasons, I mean, this book is controversial, even in Jewish circles, because there are a fair number of Jews who worry about that with cause, who believe that anti-Semitism is so ingrained in Islam and in Christianity that there's no way that you can kind of get through the anti-Semitism. Now, in a conversation I had with a very prominent Jew on this subject, I said, well, look, cultures do change. When I was a kid, you would not have, I mean, blacks were viewed as intellectually inferior and lazy and a whole bunch of things. Well, look what's happened in my lifetime. We now have a black president. We now have a black attorney general. Conservatives, and Bob, excuse me, but I count myself as one, but conservatives, I think, are as delighted to see that they were wrong about that and that the blacks are just as talented as anybody else on this planet. And I think that's great. Cultures do change. And that's my hope is that I could make a small contribution that way and people would realize that, you know, the Jews have done a lot and they deserve more honor than being put upon.
Well, Steve, I will tell you this. I am amazed and absolutely almost dumbstruck with the book as far as I've gotten, about halfway, like I said. And I will tell you further that I've got three teenagers in the house that we are desperately trying to.
Maybe they need a bar mitzvah gift.
Well, exactly. And what's going to happen is I'm going to pass this along to them. And I don't pass every book that comes through this studio to them. And I will pass this along to them because living here in Appalachia as we do, this is very much still a very, very Scots-Irish enclave.
Sure it is.
The Temple Beth Hillbilly down in Charleston, you know, we just don't get down there a whole lot.
But, you know, one of the other things you can tell your kids is that there was also a golden age of Scottish achievement. You know, there's a period of time there where the Scots were also disproportionately high achievers. So it doesn't have to be a unique cultural phenomenon.
No, and it doesn't. And in a way, I see some parallels between the Scots-Irish and the Jewish people because they are both put upon people who rose above significant hardships. In very, very different ways. Although I will posit that the Scots-Irish are considerably crankier.
Yeah, well, they can occasionally have their feuds, if I recall, from that part of the world. So.
We maintain the word here in the hills of Appalachia to this day, Steve. Steve, it has been an absolute joy talking with you, and frankly, it has made my evening.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted you were kind enough to invite me on, and I hope. Pleased that you thought it was worth it.
And I will pass word back to Candy that we had a lovely conversation. Tell me, do you have a preferred method whereby people can obtain the book?
Well, the book is available in hard copy and paperback and Kindle, and hopefully soon it'll be available in the iPad store. It can be had at Barnes & Noble. It can be had at Amazon.com or at the book's own website, which is goldenageofjewishachievement.com.
And is there supplementary material there at the website as well?
Yeah, there is. There's two websites, JewishAchievement.com and GoldenAgeOfJewishAchievement.com, and a blog, Jewish Achievement blog, which Candy has helped set up.
Wonderful. Well, Steve, I wish you the very best with the book, and thank you for taking it on, because it's certainly a story worth telling, and I hope will open up windows of knowledge for people who might have not otherwise had them open.
Great, Bob. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, my absolute distinct pleasure and honor, Steve. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. And that was Stephen Pease, author of The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement from Deucalion Books, available, as he noted, at various and sundry booksellers, as well as at the website itself, The Golden Age of Jewish Achievement, goldenageofjewishachievement.com. If you have a passion for what has made the great part of this country great, books and works like Steve's are essentials on the bookshelf. You know, there's another author out there who wrote a series of books, how the Irish saved civilization, sailing the wine dark sea, why the Greeks matter. I can't remember his name, but this is about twice as thick as any one of those. And it is absolutely, absolutely imperative, for anyone who has a passionate love for American history, because this is first and foremost American history. And had we gone on and done another hour or so, maybe we would have talked about, the fact that the United States. And we recognize the flaws of our nation, and by recognizing the flaws of our nation, we seek to correct them and make them better in future generations. But as compared to other countries around the globe, the United States offered to the Jewish people something that no other country did. And that was an opportunity to participate fully in the body politic, own property, and all the things that Europe had largely said, don't think so. And when an oppressed people are offered those opportunities, they will frequently blossom. And this book is a recounting of the full flower of the golden age of Jewish achievement. Don't hesitate to get your hands on it. You will enjoy the read. So there you have it. It's about 10 minutes past 8. I was so I was so taken up by the conversation itself that, well, I didn't take time to pull up a bumper. So I'm in a bad way here. Anybody got any suggestions? It's been kind of a scattershot Thursday, and I apologize for that. But the content, I think, has been good. How do you just pull up what bumps out of that conversation? Let me check here and see if anybody's got any suggestions in the chat room. Oh, let's see. I try to make the bumpers match the. Well, doggone it, I don't have an MP3 of Hava Nagila going here. The closest I had was the Manfred Mann Earth Band with the Shores of Babylon. Come on, give me a break here. Maybe if I had some Kinky Friedman music. No, I don't have any Kinky Friedman music. I don't know. And I don't just want to... Oh, come on, there's got to be something here. Oh, wait a minute. Okay, well, no, I don't like that. Let's see. Maybe if I could... Well, maybe I'm... You know what? I'm going to punt. I'm not going to take a top-of-the-hour break. I'm going to be extremely grateful for the phone call that's rolling in right now, and then we'll take a break. How's that work? Okay? It's a miracle on this National Day of Prayer. Hallelujah. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hey, Jim.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Anyway, I just ordered that book.
Oh, did you?
Mm-hmm. I did indeed. And, I enjoyed that very much.
Fascinating conversation, I thought. It's history that does. I worry, honest to God, I worry, Jim. And I think apparently Steve Pease had, from what I heard, he had taken a little bit of that worry from people inside the Jewish community that putting together something like this might fan the fires of anti-Semitism. But dadgummit, we can't hide history on account of morons, can we?
No, you can't. You know, it's ironic. During the Great Plague, you mentioned that, and the only country that welcomed the Jews during the plague was Poland. And that was under Casimir the Great, and he invited them to come into Poland. The rest of the countries are throwing them out.
That I had forgotten. That is true. That is absolutely true.
That's one reason that Poland was just filled with so many of the Jewish people. And, of course, after the war, that, unfortunately, was no longer the case at all. Pursuant to one of the things you were talking about earlier concerning the DOD practices or DOD regs governing the chaplains and things.
Mm-hmm.
Take a look at AR PAM 165-13. And that'll give you everything you need to know about what the guidelines are for the establishment and the practicing of religion among the components of the military.
And, I mean, for those of us who can't go and grab it...
On the internet.
Yeah, I know, but what is it?
It is a DAPAM that governs the practice and the handling of how the religions of each soldiers are to be treated.
And, I mean, it is... I assume that it says that everybody's religious preferences will be honored and respected and not denigrated and...
Exactly. It's the army will show, the military will show no preference toward any religion. And basically what it does, it divides the religions into, well, the first one is in the table of contents, you'll see Christian heritage groups, okay? The second one will be Indian heritage groups. The third is Islamic groups. The fourth is Japanese heritage groups. The fifth is Jewish groups. Then Sikh or Sant, M-A-N-T, Mont groups. And then it has other groups. And under the other groups, Baha'i Faith, Church of Satan, Church of Scientology, Church of Universal and Triumphant, Gardnerian, Wicca, I Am Religious Activity, Rastafarian, Temple of Set, a whole plethora.
Temple of Set?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
It's all over.
And you know, that's the whole point, Jim. It's not that Franklin Graham was disinvited, so to speak, because he's a Christian, although that's what he's out there bleating about. He showed up on Fox News a couple of nights ago saying, I can foresee a time when merely proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ in this country will be determined to be hate speech. And you know, of course, it was on Fox, and I'm sitting there thinking, oh, yeah, and all the droolers and knuckleheads, yeah, yeah, that's right, we're going to be a mandatory Satan-worshipping nation.
Well,
but that's not what happened at all, is it, Jim? He was disinvited because he was creating dissent by advancing one religion over another.
Well, the way these people sometimes portray their faith, the way they do it, and as much as they try not to do so, as far as with them, it's coming across as hate speech from their own mouths. Think about it.
Yes, it does.
I mean, that's just the way I perceive it. I have my own preferences, and we've talked about that years past. But, you know, I believe that this country was based upon religious freedom and the exercise thereof, as long as, you know, you're not doing stuff that is causing people, you know, endangerment or whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And
But, you know, there's none so blind as those who will not see, Jim.
Oh, I know that.
And these fools are so hung up on their sad, sick, twisted, pathological insistence that they somehow be perceived as being persecuted, because it goes into their Christ fetish, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful that way, I hope you know.
Oh, no.
But they fetishize the passion of Christ as opposed to the life of Christ, and as a consequence, I'm being persecuted in his name, just like it says in the book.
Well, even Christ himself said that there would be many people, false prophets, who would speak in his name. And he would say to them, depart from me, I know ye not.
Ye wicked and iniquitous, or something along those lines, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, some of these people really need to reread the Sermon on the Mount. They really do.
Well, you say need to reread. I say need to read.
Okay, they need to read it.
Because, you know what, for being Billy Graham's boy, it's pretty obvious to me that Franklin has never read Matthew chapter 6, you know, which we started the program with.
I've never had any serious problems with his father. I do have with him.
Well, I kind of do, you know, that conversation with Richard Nixon about, well, and lo and behold, this works into our conversation with Mr. Pease. You know, I tell you, President Nixon will never be able to do anything to turn this country back to God until we do something about those Jews in Hollywood.
I think Billy Graham was very sorry he ever had that conversation.
I think he was very sorry the conversation got taped.
Well, a lot of people were sorry about certain tapings that were made during the Nixon White House, weren't they? I mean, I think Nixon wished that he had never had seen a tape recorder. Don't you think?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Lord in heaven. I mean, the stuff that man said, and, you know, he was just
just don't understand me, Henry.
Well, he was such a, he could have been so great and could have done so much, and he did do certain things. But he was so seriously flawed in his character and just so paranoid. You know, you won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore, and then, you know.
Or the accounts of him whacked out of his mind on Seconal and vodka, talking to the portraits in the White House.
Well,
and you know, they made such light. They made light of Hillary Clinton talking about feeling the spirit of Eleanor Roosevelt. But you know, Dick Nixon was actually loaded out of his mind talking to portraits.
Have you seen that movie with Nixon with Frank Langella?
Yes,
that's a good movie.
It is.
The interviews, but with David Frost. I don't know how far I forget the English actor who plays him.
Yeah, Frost Nixon. That was Ron Howard did that, didn't he?
I'm not sure. I think so. But Frank Langella did a marvelous job as Nixon, and the other did an equally good a job as David Frost. Mr. Nixon certainly was accustomed to using his dirty tricks, and you know, he was just very paranoid, and he had some there was a lot of adverse pathology in his composure.
Oh,
a lot of adverse pathology. And I'll tell you, he could spit you up and grind you up when he wanted to, and he would pull no punches, that's for sure. I mean, people have talked about FDR and LBJ. I mean, every president we've ever had has had his darker side, but Richard Nixon had one of the darkest sides of any human being I've ever known. And yet, he was such a capable man as far as foreign policy and things like that are concerned.
Well, I will say now, what as evil and wicked as he proved to be in office, Jim, I will say now, and I will say evermore, that Richard Nixon would not be, imagine this, and this isn't a comment on Richard Nixon, this is a comment on 2010. Jim, Richard Nixon would not be welcome in the Republican Party in 2010.
No, he would not be. He would be entirely too far left and too progressive and too much into the other camp for these current Republicans who have just, they've just polarized this nation beyond any point of reconciliation that I can see, Bob. I hate to tell you that. I think the country has become so polarized because of the way some of these people think, and you've got Rupert Murdoch and Fox News and these other idiots like Rush Limbaugh and some of the other people we've talked about, and they have just basically taken advantage of the fact that people have become dumber over the decades, and they don't know history, and they don't read, and they just accept every little bit of visual pablum coming out of that TV set from Fox as being the gospel truth. Well, if so-and-so says it, it's got to be true, and I don't have to check it. They don't bother to check it because they're too damn lazy, and they're too damn dumb, and they're too damn ignorant. And they're ignorant because they want to be.
Don't forget lazy, Jim. You can't be that dumb without being lazy.
Right, fat, dumb, and stupid. And, you know, in this information age, and all you have to do is just, with a few keystrokes, pull up just about anything you want to. You don't have to go to the library. You don't have to pull up a big book and pull it down from the shelf. All you have to do is just go to your computer, and it's there. Or you can pick up the phone and call your library and call your reference person, and they'll check it for you. If you don't have a computer.
Yeah, librarians are nice that way.
Well, you give them a reason to exist. And they enjoy doing what they do, or they would not do what they do. And, but like I say, that was a very good conversation you had with the gentleman, and it was very informative. And
well, I hope you enjoy the book, and thank you for purchasing it. I will pass it along. They will be glad to know that that they moved a book.
Yeah.
And you will be moved by the book.
Amazon, 1413, paperback, new. And, that's a reasonable price for a book. And I'll just add it to all the books that I have stacked on my reading table. I've gotten to the point now that like I say, my eyes are beginning to turn back at the sight of a dust jacket. Another book I read just recently over the weekend was The Lion of Hollywood about Louis B. Mayer.
Oh, wow. I meant to ask you, Jim, tell me again, who is the author of, what was it, the book you mentioned, Southern Ladies and Gentlemen?
Florence King.
Florence King. Let me write that down right now because I was having a conversation the other day and I was trying to remember her name. And when the opportunity presents itself, I simply must get my hands on it.
And Confessions of a Failed Southern Lady or Woman. That's another one.
And that's her, too?
Yeah.
Which one do you recommend first?
The first one we talked about.
Southern Ladies and Gentlemen. All right. Jim, good to hear from you, and I'll be interested to hear your take on the book.
Okay. And like I say, pull up that AR Pam and take a look and see what it says.
Okay, I absolutely will.
It was first published in 1978, and of course they undergo constant revision and things of that nature. But I still have somewhere here an original pamphlet that was given to me by one of the troops when I worked at Fort Jackson. It has a description of each religion and what their funerary practices are, and how chaplains should handle that. That's one of the reasons they initiated that DA pamphlet, was because they needed to know exactly how burials and things would be carried out to respect the deceased preferences and those of their family.
And I know the Wiccans had a Dickens, didn't mean to rhyme like that, of a problem.
They did, but that in 1978... there in the original pamphlet is a whole section devoted to the Wiccans.
And yet under the Bush administration, they had to struggle to get something as simple as a gravestone.
And he had to, of course, publicly apologize for that. He sure as hell did.
I wish he would publicly apologize for a whole bunch more, Jim.
Well, ain't it the truth. However, they did catch him on that, and he did stick his foot in his mouth. I saw an interesting news article on him today about the book his wife wrote, and she was talking about George from age, well, until he became 40 years old. And she said it wasn't a matter of the bottle of her. It was a matter that I think after his 40th birthday, he... had such a bad hangover that he said he had to quit. So he must have really pulled the doozy, but they said his three...
Yeah, because I've never had one of those. I'm kidding.
You never have, huh?
No, the ones that made you, I'll never touch the stuff again? No.
Oh, boy. You're lucky. You are so fortunate. You are truly blessed because...
That's not to say I haven't been crippled the day after a couple of times.
Well, I can tell you... Oh boy!
But I think that's more I think that's more personality than toxicity.
Well,
because there are certain. Oh Jesus! Just what was it? Richard Pryor. Richard Pryor once said, "Dear Lord, don't let me throw up again. I ain't got nothing to throw up but my balls."
Well, there you go. The best cure for any hangover is a Valium or a Xanax. That's for sure.
I always go with 2 aspirins and 16 ounces of ice-cold water, but, who am I?
Some people believe in more hair of the dog that bit you, but I never will subscribe to that. But
no, the dog has never been any kinder the next morning than he was the night before.
But finishing up here, George's primary drinks were beer, bourbon, and the last thing, you won't believe it, Benedictine brandy.
That stuff's got more sugar in it than sweet iced tea. That would give a rock a hangover.
Well, that's kind of wonderful after a good meal or something like that, though.
Yeah,
I prefer, but those bucks know what they're doing now. They really do. B&B is, just.
I've always been a Grand Marnier man myself, but.
Well, there you go. But it was an interesting book that she wrote, that she's writing. I'm thinking about buying that, but I don't know. Maybe I'm going to have to borrow that one. But
yeah, let the taxpayers buy that one and get it from the library, Jim. Don't contribute directly to their wealth.
Yeah. But anyway, I just thought I would let you know about the stuff we discussed, and hope you have a good evening.
All right. Take care, Jim. Thank you kindly.
Good night, sir.
Bye now. And, Marty chiming in. A friend's favorite saying, avoid hangovers, stay drunk. No, what does Jimmy Buffett call it? Commode hugging drunk? Yeah. And shame on me. Shame upon me. Sitting here scrambling around trying to find a song to bump out with by a Jewish rock star. And can't remember any of them. Somebody should call in my DJ card. Let's try a few on for size. Robert Allen Zimmerman, anybody? Hey, wait a minute, let me check. Chat room. Yeah, you guys are a bunch of help. Nope, no Bob Dylan suggestions from the chat room. Sorry. No Lou Reed suggestions either. No Beastie Boys, no Billy Joel. Wouldn't play Billy Joel anyway. No Joey Ramone, no Gene Simmons. Gene Simmons, by the way, being Chaim Weitz. Art Garfunkel, sorry. Perry Farrell of Jane's Addiction and Porno for Pyros. You know, where's Tim from Los Angeles when I need him to scream out, Geddy Lee? And then there's all of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Anthony Kiedis, Hillel Slovak, Michael Balzeri. That would be Flea. And then, you know, from old school, Bangagong, anybody, T-Rex, Michael Feld, otherwise known as Mark Bolan, Danny Elfman, perhaps. Sheesh. But, you know, it works out kind of nicely because I got some Lou Reed here to bump out with and finish out with a little detail on George Reeker that you might not have heard yet that our good friend Peter Godbold sent along. It works on both levels. Lou Reed, eponymous Jewish rock star with subject matter that speaks oh so plainly to the George Reeker story. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You are, in fact, listening to the horn.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked her way across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way. Shaved her legs and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side. She was everybody's darling, but she never lost her head. Even when she was given head, she says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls go do 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 do. Gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay. A hustle here and a hustle there. New York City is the place where they said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey Joe, take a walk on the wild side. Sugar Plum Fairy came and hit the streets, looking for soul food and a place to eat. Went to the Apollo, you should have seen him go, go, go. They said, hey, sugar, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. All right. Ha. Jackie is just speeding away. Thought she was James Dean for a day. Then I guess she had to crash. Valium would have helped that fast. She said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls say, doot, 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 doot.
Song. And the sax solo at the end, Walk on the Wild Side, Lou Reed, Jewish rock star. Talk about breaking ground. How's that? That song came out and charted all over the United States. Got played. Even with obvious sexual references at a time when obvious sexual references, you know, were not okay. Plucked his eyebrows and then he was a she and said, hey, baby. Between that and the Kinks. Oh, geez. No, I can't find no Jewish rock stars. Mark Knopfler! I'm so ashamed. No, between that and the Kinks, those were real door openers, world changers. You know what? Who are you? What are you thinking? You know, you're a little. You know, you're growing up in Kalispell or Pocatello. Or, God knows, Douglas, Arizona. Or Terlingua, Texas. Or, yeah, Florence, Alabama. And you turn on the AM radio and you hear that. You ain't heard that before. Breaking ground. Breaking ground. Speaking of stuff you haven't heard before, you probably know by now the story of George Reeker. I touched on it briefly in my Franklin Graham rant earlier. Scott from Massachusetts chiming in to say, you did not just say he hired him to carry his bag. Well, yeah, I did. How can you not? Now, George Reeker... just in case you've been under a rock for 2 or 3 days, George Reeker is not just some guy with a bad rug, although he is most definitely a guy with a bad rug. George Reeker, Reekers, Reeker, Reekers, it is certainly an appropriate name, is one of the nastiest homophobes in the United States. Vile, sickening. Puts out a sort of eugenicist science, phony baloney pseudoscience, to talk about why homosexuals cannot be trusted around little children, or to adopt, or to marry, has written papers that purport to be psychologically sound research that turn out to be little more than Ken Starr-esque, weird, sick screeds fascinated with how gay people make love to each other. And you probably already know that he's an octogenarian. You probably already know that along with James Dobson, the man who advises Christian men to get in the shower with their little boys and flash their penises at them so as to keep them from catching to gay, you probably already know that he founded the Family Research Council, now headed by Tony and Norman Perkins. You probably know all that. You know that this guy is another sad right-wing evangelical fundamentalist closet case. But you don't know this. You know that George Reeker is in Florida. You know that he went to a website called rentboy.com. Probably thought it had something to do with that god-awful musical. No, it's kind of hard. I hope no one in the NSA or anything has a look at my, because I went to rentboy.com. I kind of had to have a look. It was strictly an academic journalistic enterprise. Because I wanted to see. I wanted to put George Reeker's statement to the test. He said he was going to be traveling abroad. Well, I will leave that potential pun alone. He said he was going to be traveling abroad, and you know he was not in the best of health, and he needed help with his luggage. And I guess a red cap at the airport won't do, nor will a bellman, a cab driver, or all the other various and sundry. Assorted people who will help you with your luggage. You know, the bellman will really, really, when you got George Reeker money, the bellman will come into your room and open your suitcase and put your stuff away for you and does not expect a reach around in return. But no, George Reeker, fundamentalist, gay baiter extraordinaire, he had to go to rentboy.com. And trust me when I say, as a straight but not narrow guy, trust me when I say that I don't care if you are being strangled to death through the top of your cranium by your bad rug. There is no way you can look at rentboy.com and think that you are renting a boy to carry your luggage. No, you can't. No, they, because, you know, they're very handsome men without shirts, and they're young, and they make very clear what it is that it's all about. Unless George Reeker, who claims to have written several papers in English, suddenly lost his ability to comprehend English and apparently went blind as well. Well, then again, that will make you go blind, they say. But anyway, no, he hired a rent boy to travel with him to Europe to help him with his luggage. You know, God bless the Repiglicans. They give us so many delightful euphemisms. The word wide stance now has entirely different meaning. I mean, there was a time in a more innocent America when a wide stance merely meant that a batter in a baseball game took up a lot of room in the batter's box. Doesn't mean that anymore. They gave us hiking the Appalachian Trail. That's what, no, that has nothing to do with enjoying the great outdoors and everything to do with enjoying the great indoors, preferably in Argentina with one's mistress when one is a family values Republican. And now we get, I needed help with my luggage. Which translates it to, you know, I needed someone to handle my bag. You see how hard it is not to work the blue side of the street with this story? It's heartbreakingly difficult. But unrepentant to the bitter end. I said bitter end, didn't I? This is going to be a challenge. Mr. Reeker. Why do I think of the Muppet character Beaker when I say Mr. Reeker, nonetheless, hired his rent boy and claims to this day that there was nothing dirty about it and that we were only friends. Reminds me of an old David Letterman bit where he showed the young guy standing next to Orville Redenbacher and said, that's not his nephew, that's his longtime companion, yin. No, unrepentant, he continued to claim that this was all platonic, when no one in their right mind would think so. George Reeker. But there's more, because anytime you're dealing with right-wing hypocrisy, you know that you are always dealing with a Ginsu commercial. But wait, there's more. Because George Reeker isn't just some garden variety, deeply closeted homophobe living in Florida. No, if you live in Florida and you are an activist for anything relating to human rights or marriage equity, if you are a taxpayer in Florida, you know what? You helped to pay for George Reeker's rent boy. You really did. Right-wing sicko, Attorney General of Florida Bill McCollum, spent $87,000 on George Reeker. Why? He used George Reeker, who needed his bags handled, by a rent boy to serve as an expert witness in litigation to defend the bigotry that stalks Florida that prevents a gay couple from adopting a child desperately in need of parents. Reeker's and what Equality Florida describes as a cohort which is not to say rent boy, which is not to say that that there were any bag that Reeker had a bag needing handling during the adoption litigation. Reekers and a cohort were expert witnesses. They were paid $87,000 to defend the anti-gay adoption bigotry. And of the $87,000 of Florida taxpayer money that was paid to Reeker and his cohort, fully $60,000 of it went to Reeker himself. There were only two witnesses called by Attorney General Bill McCollum, right-wing punk-ass bigot, in that litigation. Walter Shum, and George Reeker. That's it. Equality Florida notes that $87,000 is 2.5 years' worth of salary to the average American. And he did so knowing full well that Reeker's testimony had been widely discredited within the United States. The Arkansas Supreme Court and a judge, Timothy Fox, said Reeker's testimony was worthless as evidence because it was only his personal view, not an expert view. Now, of course, who put Reekers on to testify? Whose administration put Reekers on to testify in Arkansas? Here's a hint. His son got caught beating a dog to death at Boy Scout camp. That's right. The Mike Huckabee administration paid George Reeker to get on the stand and talk about how bad it was when homosexuals is allowed to raise cheerings. The Arkansas Supreme Court reached the conclusion that Reeker's testimony was pointless, and it went so far as to declare the Huckabee administration's anti-gay rule unconstitutional. Reeker's, of course, drew a big fee in that case, too. So, well, one is well able to understand how one could afford a rent boy when one is a closeted, self-loathing homophobe who travels the country spitting on gay communities in states that have benighted, misbegotten legislatures that try to enshrine bigotry within the law itself. By the way, just to create a little bit of diversion, you know what else Reeker said when he was paid $60,000 by the taxpayers of Florida? He also said that Native Americans, otherwise known as Indians, shouldn't be allowed to adopt in Florida. Why? Because they have drinking problems. Reekers looked at the case of a child living with a set of parents who were of the same sex, who had been in that home for over 10 years, and with no moral compunction moving him whatsoever, recommended that that child be ripped from the loving arms of its parents. He further testified that even though the child had been with those parents for 10 years, it would only take a year or so in the loving, kind care of a good, decent, upstanding, godly, heterosexual couple for the child to just get over being raised by the homos. George Reeker should be sued by the state of Florida for fraud. And every penny paid him should be recovered from him. Secondly, there's a problem, though, because the person who would sue George Reeker for Reekers for fraud would generally be the Attorney General of the state of Florida, who is actually his patron in bigotry. So let's up the ante just a little bit, shall we? Not only should George Reekers be sued for fraud and his rug, but Florida Attorney General Bill McCollum should be impeached and removed from office. Proceedings should be begun against him for fraud upon the court within the rules established by the State Bar of Florida. Reekers should never be allowed to get on the witness stand and testify and hide his bigotry behind the veil of some sort of twisted psychological expertise, nor should Bill McCollum ever be allowed in a courtroom again to represent anyone, let alone the incredibly diverse population of the people of the state of Florida. I really appreciate Peter sending this along to me. It's real easy to do the funny stuff about the George Reekers of the world, but his bigotry has real-world implications. And he has done great harm to great numbers of people in Florida and in other states as well. And it is of that that we should be most profoundly aware. So the program has been kind of all over the place tonight, and I apologize for to the extent that I was responsible for that. But you know what? Turned out to be a pretty daggum good show, if I do say so myself. I invite you to join me tomorrow night for Friday on the Front Porch. By that time, Ferg will have been made a Knight of the Golden Horseshoe, a signal honor here in the state of West Virginia for a young man or young lady. We'll talk about that some more, or not. Thanks to everybody who helps keep this program going. We are into April. We are almost a month into April. We are trying to reach our April fundraising goal, and we are, as usual, in the hole. Your support is what keeps all of this going. It is much appreciated, not only by the folks here at the Horn, and the folks at the Horn who are all over the planet, but it is also appreciated by those who listen to the Horn and yet themselves cannot contribute. What you do for the whole Horn family. And it is beautiful work. PayPal button and snail mail address are at headonradionetwork.com, the snail mail address being under the contribute tab in the ongoing redesign of the website. Thanks to everybody who helps make this go, from John Fox, who's redoing the website, and so many other things, to Peter Godbold, who's always there to answer computer questions whenever they the devil and perplex me, to Ben Birch, without whom there would be no stream whatsoever, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks go out to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, to our blogger, Texas Betsy, to our Southeast correspondent, Matt Osborne, Osborne, Inc., OSBORNEINK.com. If you have not gone to Osborne, Inc. and followed the link to vote for Matt Osborne in the Netroots Nation Scholarship Competition, I implore you please to do so. It's easy, it's quick. Last year, you made me the number one vote-getter in the entire competition. It would be great if a horn person could win that signal honor 2 years running. So please do it. Osborne, Inc., OSBORNEINK.com. My head writer is David in Tennessee. Many thanks go out. Also, thanks go out, as ever, to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
And a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute past the hour, this is the Thursday edition of The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid, you know that. My apologies about yesterday, but frankly, it weren't my fault. Anytime we see phone company trucks running up and down our little road here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia, it spells, well, it doesn't spell anything good for us and our connection here. And such was the case yesterday. It's been a weird couple of days. Yesterday it was phone company trucks running up and down the road. And then today, I'd say about an hour and a half ago, maybe 2 hours ago, the whole house was turned on its ear when a flight of fighter jets, five of them, went over the house at maybe somewhere between 500 and 1,000 feet and just about rattled the windows out of the building. Thanks, guys. We'll sleep better tonight knowing you're on the job. I guess they're doing aerial surveillance for hillbilly car bombers or something, though how you can see anything at that speed, I'll never know. Yeah, it was a little weird. Broke the sound barrier, everything. I got a feeling that's not according to Hoyle, but like I'm going to complain. I mean, these guys are notorious for, you know, bombing wedding parties and saying oopsie and machine-gunning journalists and saying, I'll be damned, I thought the camera was a gun. You all saw he had a camera. So, I probably won't complain. Beyond that, I hated missing the program last night because it was the prayer meeting Wednesday. But in a way, I suppose we can make up for it. Because this is, after all, the National Day of Prayer. Hallelujah. Glory to God. Franklin Graham, who wasn't allowed to pray at the Pentagon. Oh, my God. These poor little attention whores. Because he was disinvited, because he is a hate-filled maggot, Franklin Graham decided to pray in the parking lot of the Pentagon. Dear Father, bless this asphalt to thy mercy and thy glory. No, really, I'm not kidding. Whining and pissing and moaning about having been banned by the Pentagon from sharing God's love. I love you. Franklin Graham went out there. Yeah. And prayed in the in the parking lot. Really? And see, that stuff really, really rubs up against me. For a variety of reasons. How can I explain this? I've described myself on a number of occasions as a recovering Southern Baptist. Because what they do to your mind when you are a child and a young person in that fundamentalist church, if another government was doing it to an American citizen, we would declare it a violation of the Geneva Conventions. It's awful. And it's not limited to Southern Baptists. Lord knows how many times Bart Kopp has remarked on his page about the things that were done to his mind as he was raised Roman Catholic. I imagine there are recovering Lutherans out there, if you want to get right down to it. Maybe even recovering Hindus. But for me, it's a matter of being a recovering Southern Baptist. And, of course, Billy Graham, who is the father of Franklin Graham, comes out of that Baptist tradition, that tent meeting tradition. And when you're little and you're in the basement of the Baptist church and the little old blue-haired ladies are teaching you all about, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that whosoever might believeth on him might have everlasting life, and do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and you're all sitting in a circle singing, Jesus loves the little children. And then they let, when you're old enough to make, when they're old enough, they're fairly sure that you're not going to either vomit, fart, belch, or, you know, do anything else in the service, they'll let you go up to big church. And that's where you go from, you know, dear Jesus, take care of my best friend. Amen. To those great big long-winded prayers that the deacons give because they're showing off their praying skills at the same time they're showing off their new Botany 500 polyester three-piece suit in a sort of muted forest green with gold stitching along the lapels and their little plastic carnation boutonniere, if you will. And it creates a little bit of cognitive dissonance because all along you've been encouraged to read the Bible. And, you know, the first book of the New Testament's Matthew. And you don't have to go far into Matthew before you get to Matthew chapter 6. And I think I've remarked upon this before, but it bears repeating. If you want to understand what a sick, pernicious, perfidious, ain't a word of truth in him piece of human rubbish Franklin Graham is,
then all you got to do is read Matthew chapter 6 of the book that he claims guides his life. Not yours, not mine. His. Take heed that you do not do your alms before men to be seen of them. Otherwise you have no reward of your Father which is in heaven. What does Franklin Graham run?